Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show improve. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
The gay rights movement is changing everything.
Lawmakers around the country have debated so-called bathroom bills, which prohibit transgender people from using restrooms that match their gender identity. The author of one such bill in Virginia is up for re-election, and his opponent is a transgender woman. NPR's Sarah McCammon reports that if she succeeds, she would be the country's first openly transgender state lawmaker.
Danica Rome's message to voters is pretty standard for a local politician.
I am running this race because I am here to fix your local infrastructure problems.
As she pounded the podium at a local Democratic Party meeting, Rome ticked off a list of challenges facing voters in House District 13 in the outer Washington, D.C. suburbs. Rome is focusing on bread-and-butter concerns, like funding for roads and other infrastructure, something she says she's uniquely informed about because of her years working as a newspaper reporter in the region.
As an investigative reporter, I was part of a team that did a five-part water infrastructure investigation in Montgomery County. I mean, I could talk to you all day about tuberculation in water pipes. And
a note, I'm pretty sure she actually could.
The national guidelines stand for fire hydrants.
But most of the attention has focused on Rome's status as a transgender woman, challenging a Republican incumbent who, in addition to the bathroom bill, is known for his opposition to LGBT rights. Delegate Bob Marshall has been in office for 26 years, since Rome, now 33, was a child growing up in the area. He hasn't responded to repeated requests for interviews with NPR, but he has talked to conservative radio hosts.
Danica clearly is out here doing this for making a marker in the national character.
That's Marshall speaking on American Family Radio's Sandy Rios in the Morning show in September.
That you can engage in this behavior, which clearly goes against the laws of nature and nature's God, and hold public office to make decisions on behalf of the common good.
Talking with Rios, Marshall also speculated about Rome's process of transitioning from male to female.
It's a guy who dresses like a woman. I don't think there's been any surgery. He's been described, far as I know.
Correct.
Yeah, so...
Right.
One, gross. Number two, stop. Why are you doing this?
In an interview at her campaign office in Manassas, Rome said Marshall should focus on substantive issues, not her gender. But Rome doesn't shy away from talking about her gender identity. She's responded to Marshall with an online ad showing her taking hormone replacement therapy medication.
I'm Danica Rome. I'm running for office because my identity shouldn't be a big deal.
Meanwhile, Marshall has pointed out that Rome's transgender identity has helped her raise hundreds of thousands of dollars from pro-LGBT donors. Kira Ongwele is a lecturer in the politics department at the University of Virginia.
While she has said that she's not running on that issue, it is very clearly part of her campaign, and she's talking about it a lot on Twitter. She's talking about it a lot in interviews.
Ongwele says that may be a good strategy for mobilizing Democrats, but it may be a tougher sell for moderates. That's especially true in off-year elections, which tend to turn out more conservative voters, the kind who may be reluctant to back a trailblazing candidate like Danica Rome. Sarah McCammon, NPR News, Manassas, Virginia.
Seattle's a great place to visit because it has I guess you could say a little bit of everything, but I like to think of it as a lot of everything.
You're listening to KNKX, and as we approach Election Day, we're looking at local races throughout Western Washington. Next up, we're stopping in Burien, about 10 miles south of downtown Seattle. The city is fresh off a fierce debate about whether it should be a sanctuary city with policies protecting undocumented immigrants. The fight tore open a divide in Burien, splitting neighbors over issues like immigration and racial justice. 88.5's Will James reports that divide is helping define this year's election.
If you talk to people around Burien, they'll tell you elections here used to be about potholes and streetlights. But something's changed. I catch Joseph Saya as he's walking through Burien's downtown.
Yeah, it's a little insane. There's two pretty strong camps.
Lisa Parks agrees. She's lived here 35 years and says local politics are more heated than ever.
It's devastating. I feel like Burien has always been a really friendly town, and it hurts me to see the division.
What people disagree on is when Burien politics started to change and who's to blame. If you ask Jimmy Matta, things started changing here right after the 2016 election, when something dark seemed to wake up in Burien. It all started with a scene he witnessed between two men at a supermarket.
I seen this individual that was smiling and this other individual that was very upset. And the individual smiling was Latino, so I was wondering if he was understanding what was going on. So I wanted to make sure he was okay.
Matta approached the two men.
And the guy turns around and says, "Yep, that's right. Your president is gone. You're going back home." So shocking to me, right? Because this is my home. I'm an American.
Matta was born in Idaho, and his parents are from Guatemala. He grew up as a farm worker in eastern Washington. He says it was that day in the supermarket that he decided to run for Burien City Council. In the months after that, he says, similar incidents happened to his son, his daughter, his mom, and they're still happening.
I was walking the other day, and this guy had a Trump shirt on, and he pointed at Trump. And I smiled, and I just waved at him, right? I mean, what am I supposed to respond to that? Guy's pointing at Trump, like, you know, is it that you're telling me that he's going to come for me? I mean, what are you trying to say, right?
Trump's election happened after years of change in Burien. Since 2000, the city's Latino population has nearly tripled, while the white population has stayed pretty stagnant. Meanwhile, residents say younger and more progressive people have brought a new style of politics to town. These forces collided with an older, whiter Burien during the past year's sanctuary city debate. A few weeks after Trump won the election, the Burien City Council passed a law in a split vote saying city staff and police can't ask about a resident's immigration status. Then there was a repeal effort. The debates at City Hall sounded like this. The sanctuary city law survived the repeal effort, and the debate quieted down. But lines were drawn. Now Burien is left with a slate of candidates who protested the repeal and other candidates who supported it. On Facebook pages, like one called Take Back Burien, residents are calling each other socialists and racists. There's a lot of talk about campaign lawn signs being stolen.
I was labeled as somebody who was anti-immigrant.
City Council member Debbie Wagner voted against the sanctuary city law and signed the petition to repeal it. Now she's running against Jimmy Matta to keep her seat. And she says in this race, it's gotten harder to talk to people.
I was out on the corner at a Meet the Candidates night, and a lady came up to me and said, "You don't represent me." And I said, "Why is that?" And she said, "Because you're white." And I said, "So what does that mean? Is it because of my color that I'm not fixing your roads properly or providing police?"
Wagner says when she voted against the sanctuary city law, she was mostly worried about the Trump administration cutting federal funding for the city's police. She also says she's worried about undocumented immigrants in Burien because they haven't been, as she puts it, vetted.
We don't know if we're protecting someone fleeing a drug cartel or if we're protecting the drug cartel.
The issue she's most passionate about is pollution and noise from jets at nearby SeaTac Airport. But since the sanctuary city debate, she says she spends a lot of time defending herself against accusations that she's racist. She says some people have even slammed the door in her face. Her opponent, Jimmy Matta, has had some tough door knocks as well.
You know, the other day, knocked on a door and I asked, If there was something I could fix, what would it be? I said, well, number one, teach these Mexicans how to speak English and get rid of so many Mexicans.
He says his 14-year-old daughter was campaigning with him when that happened. Berrien's population is now about half white. But since Berrien incorporated in 1993, just two people of color have sat on the city council. Matta doesn't know if he can change that, but he says he might be able to help his city heal. And that starts with conversations like the one he had with that woman who answered the door.
When I left her, I said, look, I want you to feel that you have a friend where if you feel scared or you have questions, you can go knock on the door and I'll be there to open the door. This lady broke down and cried.
Matta is no fan of all this divisiveness, but he says it is time for some hard conversations in Berrien. Will James, 88.5 News.
It's on his way, he's moving to Hollywood. He's busting into Hollywood. Show him the way, he's moving to Hollywood.
We're going to go back now to the story that's dominated news out of Hollywood these last few weeks. And this is a story because of the content that might be inappropriate or upsetting for some listeners. But now you surely know of the allegations that the powerhouse Hollywood producer Harvey Weinstein pressured women for sex and even sexually assaulted them over the course of his decades-long career. Weinstein has acknowledged inappropriate behavior but continues to claim that he believes his sexual encounters were consensual. Yesterday, in an unusual move, the Motion Picture Academy voted to expel him immediately. Now, while the allegations are shocking, they are sadly familiar. The story of a man accused of abusing his power to extract sexual favors from women. But there's a different element of the story that we want to highlight now about men experiencing abuse. Today, the Washington Post reports on men who say that Weinstein bullied and even physically attacked them. Actors Terry Crews and James Vanderbeek both tweeted about being the targets of inappropriate sexual conduct by unnamed entertainment executives. And those comments got us thinking about why we don't hear more about men and boys who may have experienced abuse. So we called Helen Benedict. She is a professor of journalism at Columbia University, and she's the author of several books about this subject. She's with us now from Columbia University. Professor Benedict, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Do you find in your reporting that there are circumstances about men and boys being targets of abuse that are distinct from that we find with women and girls?
The impulse is pretty much the same, to abuse power. You make yourself feel powerful by degrading others. It's the same impulse that torturers use. You know, most torturers use sexual humiliation as part of their tools to torture.
So turning back to the Weinstein story, Terry Crews tweeted about his fear of being, quote unquote, ostracized if he pursued any further action against an executive that he said groped him last year. James Vanderbeek, and when he said he'd been groped many times as a young actor, tweeted that, quote, there's a power dynamic that feels impossible to overcome. And hearing these men talk about this, it sounds, as you said, you know, very similar to what the women said, which is that they felt like, if I speak up, then I'm going to pay the price for this.
Exactly. And assailants are very careful usually to make sure you will feel that way. I mean, they'll often threaten you overtly. If you tell, I'll ruin your career. If you tell, I'll spread the story that you came on to me. But then when you add to it a whole institution, a powerful institution like Hollywood, the entertainment industry, the military, a campus where you have the power to kick somebody out or ruin their career or otherwise get them into terrible trouble, that just enhances the power of the assailant.
And I'm curious about the whole Terry Crews situation, too, because as you may know, you know, he's very muscular. He looks very strong. And he's 6'4". And he talked about that in one of his tweets. He talked about feeling that he would then receive the backlash if he somehow retaliated, you know, physically. You figure if Terry Crews wanted to physically defend himself, you figure he surely could have.
That is something that happens to men much more. The idea that they failed as men because they failed, in quotes, to fight back and defend themselves. You know, men are supposed to be able to do that. And a man who's grown up big and strong especially expects to be able to do that himself.
Well, as a person who has covered these stories for years now, for quite some time now, is there anything that you want to highlight about the way this Harvey Weinstein story is unfolding? It's certainly not the first time we've heard this in recent years. I mean, the Bill Cosby story comes to mind where, you know, literally dozens of women say that they were sexually assaulted by this, you know, tremendously influential, you know, Hollywood, you know, figure. And then, of course, we've seen in recent years, you know, Roger Ailes at Fox News and so forth. But do you think anything is different now, or is anything going to be different?
I see each time we get a wave of one of these stories, you know, where a series of assaults has been exposed, usually committed by someone in power. And more and more and more victims speak up because they're giving each other courage. It's the same pattern that happens every time. I think each time this happens, we take a step forward because it invites discussions like we're having right now to explore why it happens and how it affects people. And, you know, even if it's forgotten somewhat in between the waves, still we've moved the conversation forward a bit.
Helen Benedict is an author of several books that touch on the issue of sexual abuse. Her latest book actually is a novel. It's called Wolf Season. She joined us from the studios of Columbia University in New York City. Helen Benedict, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
Billie Holiday, I sing your blues. Bet your life against me and I swear to God you'll lose it. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis.
Ever wonder what the slave trade was like in St. Louis? One of our listeners did. Ann Walker, after visiting our website, wrote to Curious Lewis and asked this question.
Are information and relics from the slave pen, previously located downtown at the old Bush Stadium, currently being stored at the Missouri History Museum? And is there an exhibit about this work planned, or has it been one there in the past?
Why do you think it's particularly important to preserve physical objects?
In time immemorial, people have been using relics and statues and et cetera to leave their mark on history. So as an African-American, most of us didn't have time to sit up and make these relics and statues because we were picking cotton. It's important that the relics that do pertain to us in any sort of way then be maintained.
That's listener Ann Walker talking with producer Char Dastin. Walker is the founder and executive director of Freedom Trails, Legacies of Hope, a local nonprofit dedicated to researching African-American history. Now, to answer her question, with me in studio are Chris Gordon, the librarian at the Missouri History Museum, and Angela Da Silva, an American Cultural Studies professor at Lindenwood University and a historical reenactor. Thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Chris? Can you answer a question?
Yes. Unfortunately, when those vaults were uncovered back in 1963, they were documented only through photographs. And the actual relics do not exist. It was a time when It was kind of a double situation back then. For one thing, I don't think there was quite the interest in African American history that we have today. And sometimes those types of artifacts, those types of relics, were simply not considered as important, and they were not saved as they should have been. The other thing is the 1960s through the 1970s. In terms of development, people were not that interested in saving the old. The new was the rage. Everything wanted things to be, sparkling and new. They wanted new architecture and things like that. And there was not a real push to save a lot of architectural gems. And so it was kind of a bad situation on two fronts at that time.
That surprises me a lot because 1963 was the beginning of a decade in which civil rights was such an important subject, in which the interest was so profound.
Yeah, but it was very early on, though.
Early on in that process, Angela, you wanted to react to that?
Yes, regarding the relics that he's talking about that were not saved,
You're absolutely right. And part of saving it, the city itself, I mean, we're at the height of the civil rights movement, and they were afraid to put this on display. There's a lot of fear that was associated with this. We are trying to correct the sins of the past, so to speak, and to equalize the playing field. And yet those physical, visible reminders was not something people wanted about hanging around. And so I think it was more from that perspective while these things were not kept.
What are the artifacts that were lost or that we have photographs of?
There were actual vaults that were found when they started to do the construction of the original Busch Stadium. The vaults had been saved essentially underneath the development of what was then the Meyer Drug Company. And it was interesting because the vaults they looked just like jail cells. They were, you know, thick walls, heavy stone. And so later on, they were simply transformed into storage areas. So they served a purpose later on. But when they started doing the construction and they started knocking down the buildings, it became obvious, you know, what these had served as their purpose originally.
You call them vaults. I think they're also referred to as slave pens, where slaves were kept prior to the sale.
Exactly.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, the site was Bernard M. Lynch was the most successful slave trader, slave dealer in the city of St. Louis. Through the 1840s, 1850s, right up to the Civil War. He had an original location near 4th and Locust and essentially became so successful he needed a new location. And so he built this new facility, which, you know, he advertised as being, you know, very clean and humane and so forth, although it was simply a jail.
Do we have any sense for how many slaves were bought and sold over any period of time?
Thousands and thousands.
And that is true. One of the things about Bernard M. Lynch is why these slave pens were underground. With the location of the building, there were people living around there. And the misery, the I guess you could say the corporal punishment corrections that were administered, this, you know, and the urban legend that has been assigned to this is that when they were doing the construction for Anheuser-Busch, that they had left a piece of equipment on the ground overnight and it had fallen through the sub-basement underneath the basement to where this was located. And the reasoning being is that the hollering, the crying, the beatings would not disturb the people that lived around the slave pen. But there is a modicum of justice here regarding this particular site, because under the Union occupation of St. Louis during the Civil War, Bernard M. Lynch's slave pen turned into a prison for the same people who went there shopping. And so they were now on the other side of those bars. And so there is, like I said, there's a modicum of justice. It was built as such a sort of fortification that nobody was ever escaped. And the same reason with the Southern sympathizers who were held there afterwards. Also, too, there was another purpose that Bernard M. Lynch's slave pen held, and that it was curfew violation. That was one of the few black codes that was severely enforced in St. Louis. And black, slave and free, had to be off the street at a certain time during the weekday and a certain time, like I think it was 11 p.m. on the weekends and maybe 8 p.m. during the weekdays. If I, as a free black, could not get off the street and be in curfew violation, I would have to sign myself in the Bernard M. Lynch's slave pen to escape the 39 lashes for curfew violation. So, and he would charge a dollar what he called room and board for the night. Now, a room would be just, you know, you would be in the pen. That's number one. And then number two, board would be maybe a drink of water. But you would be, you know, but you paid him for protection.
I want to come back to you on some of this, but I want to turn to Chris for a second here. With regard to dollars and cents of the day, what was a slave sold for? Do we have records of what the pricing was like?
Yes, we do. We know from sources from the time that a slave, there was a number of factors that determined the slave's value. Age, gender, there was, but on average, it could be anywhere from $750 to $1,500, $1,800, right, which is a considerable amount of sum of money.
Absolutely.
At that time. You know, Angela had mentioned about the justice. Lynch himself was enslaved in his own slave pens at the beginning of the war. He had a reputation as being outspoken, and so he did not go quietly, essentially, and ended up sitting in his own jail cell. And when he was finally released, he took off.
That's true.
Nobody ever saw him again.
What I wanted to come back to with you, Angela, is I've seen a video of your performance during a reenactment of a slave sale.
That's correct.
And there are a couple of things about that impressed me. First, tell us what the process was like.
We had to search far and wide, number one, for a auctioneer in the what they call the tobacco tradition. And that, and instead of the English tradition, which we're now very much accustomed to, but that's the very fast talking. And we really had to, I really had a lot of conversations with him, and he had to do a lot of soul searching to be able to do this. But in the end, everyone who participated felt that the historical value of this could not be overlooked. And I can tell you, the night before, there was approximately 35 people that were involved in that. Most of them from the Blue-Gray Alliance, which is Civil War reenactors on both sides. As you saw in the video, there were reenactors to really, I mean, families brought in farm animals and, you know, and authentic wagons that came out of two museums from Mississippi. And, you know, it took a lot. The night before, we all got together. And again, this was planned by the minute because we had to anticipate how the crowd was going to act. And if A happened, then our response was going to be what? And so we decided that this whole thing couldn't be over 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. But as you saw from the beginning, we had chains forged in the slave tradition by a blacksmith over in Illinois who used replicas from museum. And we started at Lynch's slave pen. The city allowed us to close off the street. We started and rattling those chains, walking up to the courthouse, which was something that would have happened. And the night before, we all got together and seriously prayed over this because we had no idea. It had not been done since, you know, for over 25 years. And when it was done before by a very big tourist organization, they had their lunch handed to them. And a lot of people reminded me of that. And but I was bound and determined to do it because in 2011, when this was done, it was the kickoff of the sesquicentennial of the Civil War. And every cultural institution in St. Louis was meeting about how they were going to handle it. But never once going to those meetings did people talk about slavery. Mm-hmm. So I had to put it back on the table.
I was struck by the emotion that you felt in going through this. I mean, as a person of color, reenacting something that had happened 150 years earlier, it's moved you greatly, didn't it?
Yes, it did. But it wasn't just me. Mm-hmm. It was the members from the Blue-Gray Alliance. Those guys, they, from the white perspective, I don't think they expected to feel what they felt either. And there was a lot of remorse. There was a lot of guilt. But everybody in the end at the wrap-up session was awfully happy that we did it. But we all agreed we never would do it again. Mm-hmm. Okay, there was no two ways about that. Okay, it just drained you. And in my case, when the president of the Blue Gray Alliance is looking at my teeth and my eyes and calling me auntie, and how many children had I raised, and could I cook, and just all of these questions, and, you know, had me, you know, hopping on one foot to show that I was still agile at my age. That was all planned. I mean, we had to do this and be as real as possible.
Well, we end today's show in California, where raging wildfires have killed at least 41 people and scorched more than 200,000 acres, roughly the size of New York City. The fires are now the deadliest in California since record-keeping began. At least 100,000 people have been forced to evacuate, with about 75,000 displaced after their homes and businesses were destroyed. More than 11,000 firefighters are battling the blazes, and a number of them are prisoners, including many women inmates. In this clip from the film, The Prison in 12 Landscapes, an inmate with an all-woman crew describes being sent to fight a raging fire in Marin County.
My first day here, when I first got to camp, I got thrown on a fire. We had just got through orientation, and the horn went off. And I got thrown on the bus, and off we went, chasing the smoke. We're driving up the mountain and seeing dirty burn everywhere. All of a sudden, there's a 40-foot wall of flame on both sides of me.
That's a clip from PBS's Independent Lens, The Prison in 12 Landscapes. To find out more about these firefighters, we're joined by two guests in Fullerton, California, where Marilyn Ralston is with us, of California Coalition for Women Prisoners, the L.A. chapter, program coordinator for Project Rebound at Cal State University. Marilyn experienced 23 years of incarceration. While she was incarcerated, she was a fire camp trainer and a clerk for the California Department of Fire and Fire Protection. And in Los Angeles, journalist and author Jamie Lowe is with us. Her recent story in the New York Times Magazine is headlined, "The Incarcerated Women Who Fight California's Wildfires." Marilyn, if you could start off by telling us who's on the front lines. People might be surprised to hear that prisoners, among them women prisoners, are fighting California's wildfires right now.
Good morning, AB and Juan. Thank you for having me on the show. Yes, the women who are on the front line are women who volunteer for the camp training program, or they are assigned to the program because they have nonviolent offenses or classified as minimum custody. So these are women who are able to leave the prison and be housed in one of the 43 conservation camps. I'm sorry, one of the three female conservation camps.
And how is it that this program started? Who are these incarcerated women who are fighting fires?
Well, the program started many years ago, I think around World War II, where inmates became involved with fighting disasters within California, repairing roads and sandbagging, floods and earthquakes, things like that. The first conservation camp for women was opened, I believe, in 1983, which is Camp Rainbow, which was formerly a male conservation camp. So the firefighting program for female inmates have been around since 1983.
And how much are they paid compared to others who are fighting the fires on the front lines?
Well, fire pay is typically about a dollar an hour while you're in fire camp training. Some folks are paid zero for that training or up to $18 a month. And then once you get to the classroom and you are part of the field training, then that pay escalates to a whopping $48 a month. If you're a swamper, you may get paid $56 a month.
Why do women do it?
Women do it for various reasons. Several reasons are to get closer to their kids for day. You know, those types of jobs come with a huge reduction in sentence. So the credit bearing that you receive for fighting fires is worth putting your lives at risk between the time that you serve. So,
are you saying that they get to see their children if they fight the fire?
They get to see their children a lot sooner because you get a reduced sentence. You earn a different credit. You earn day for day. You get to see your children in a visiting area at a camp, not in a prison. where there are less restrictions, where the environment is more park-like. Who doesn't want that?
And Jamie Lowe, you wrote the article, The Incarcerated Women Who Fight California's Wildfires. Could you talk about some of the people you interviewed and what you found?
Sure. I talked to people who ranged in, like, many different sociological backgrounds. I found that their response to the program was anything from, you know, resenting the depth and the hardship of the work because it's intense physical labor, to a lot of appreciation for the responsibility of working within the community and doing something that was giving back to it. That said, I think that it was, you know, these women are putting their lives on the line for very little money. They make a dollar an hour when they're actually fighting fires, $2 a day in camp per day. And while the camps are nicer place to experience prison, they're still prison. They're still prisoners.
What surprised you most in your research, Jamie, for this piece for The New York Times?
Definitely that there was a real appreciation for participation. I was shocked at how many women were really. One woman I talked to, Marquette, felt, I think, transformed by doing the work. But I think it was also just really hard for her when she described being in the, like, confronted with flames and confronted with the training. It was something she, like, had never experienced before. And her description of it was so visceral and so intense that it was something that just felt outside of the lines of incarceration in some ways. It's not what you would expect. It felt more like an outward bound experience. It felt more like something, you know, these women are providing a service for the state. And
have any of the women, have any of the prisoners who are fighting the fires lost their lives?
Yes. So that's how I was first sort of not introduced, but that's what why I wanted to write about the program. I had never fully heard of it. And I read a small article about Shauna Lynn Jones, who passed away in February of 2016. And she was on one of the crews in the Malibu camp. There are three female camps. And it struck me that nobody really talked about who she was, how she got there, her background, and how she ended up dead.
A couple of weeks ago, I was supposed to be in Flint, Michigan for a charity benefit that was supposed to raise awareness for the appalling condition of the water in Flint. I don't know if you know this, but the water in Flint is fucking poisonous. It's actually making people sick.
Ever since the water crisis in Flint began, we've been checking in with Janaea McDonald. I first arrived at her house in February of last year. She was making dinner and trying to teach her boys to stay away from the water. They were 2 and 6 years old at the time.
I don't know any way to explain to a six-year-old why you can't take a bath anymore every day, why you can't help mommy wash the dishes anymore. So I told him it's poison. And that way he'll know I'm serious. Don't play with it. Even when I'm not looking, if this is poison, I better not touch it.
And Janaea McDonald joins us once again now from her home in Flint. Janaea, it's so good to talk to you again.
Oh, it's always good to talk to you, Ari.
Boy, it's been more than a year and a half since we first met. Are you still using bottled water for everything?
Every day. Wow. Nothing has changed.
Nothing has changed?
Nothing.
Are you still, like, driving all over the city to pick it up day after day?
We kind of, like, build up our supplies so we don't have to go daily, but definitely weekly we are going.
And when I met you, you were using, like, those single serving water bottles that people carry around. Do you at least have, like, bigger containers at this point?
No. Still only the single serving bottles, not even a liter bottle, just the single serving bottles by the case.
And you are still paying a monthly water bill for water that you're not using.
A very expensive monthly water bill, absolutely.
How much is it on a typical month?
Our water bill runs around $150 to $160 a month.
Wow. So how are you getting through this after more than a year and a half?
Very painfully. It's not fun. It's a burden. It's a headache. It's very sad. You know, we live in a nation that can come up with the best ideas of iPhones and iPads, but we can't even figure out how to give people safe water.
Do you ever think, forget it, it's not worth the effort, I'm just going to use the tap water, consequences be what they may?
Never. No, that's not an option for me. I will crack open single serving waters forever if I have to, but that's not an option for me to use that tap water. Not for me, not for my kids, no.
What about your neighbors and friends in Flint? Have any of them just gotten exhausted of the struggle and said, to heck with it, I'm going to use the tap?
No, no one is exhausted. As a matter of fact, we're so trained. The co-workers, friends, some neighbors I talk to when we leave out of the city of Flint, we're so trained, we don't even feel safe putting our toothbrush under a regular faucet.
Even when you leave Flint, you don't feel comfortable brushing your teeth with tap water just because you're so trained.
Absolutely. It's very nervous. It's like, okay, this, you're telling me this is safe, but I just don't feel safe.
You know, Janae, when I first met you, you said one of your big fears was that the country would forget about Flint and stop paying attention. Do you feel that that's what's happened?
A little. I feel like we were news for just a moment, enough for people to say, what a shame. But not enough for people to make a change.
How are your kids doing? I know that your youngest son was diagnosed with autism, and there's no way of knowing whether that had anything to do with the toxins in the water. How are the kids doing today?
They're healthy. I am grateful and very blessed for their health. Josiah is still struggling with his disability with autism, but I'm grateful that his words are coming. And we just take it one day at a time.
While you've got the ear of the country, is there anything you would like people to know?
Yes. Please keep Flint in your prayers. I'm prayerful and hopeful that somewhere, someone out there can understand that we need new pipes. We need new pipes for every household here in Flint, Michigan. Not just main pipes, not just for businesses. The households with the small children in it, we need new pipes in order for us to feel safe and to have comfort in knowing that our water is drinkable.
Janae McDonald, thank you for talking to us once again. We're going to keep in touch, okay?
Thank you, Ari.
I don't want us to lose sight that things are getting better. Each successive generation seems to be making progress in changing attitudes when it comes to race. Doesn't mean we're in a post-racial society. It doesn't mean that racism is eliminated. But, you know, when I talk to Malia and Sasha, and I listen to their friends and I see them interact, they're better than we are. They're better than we were on these issues. And that's true in every community that I've visited all across the country.
Some students in Weber County are getting national attention, and not for a good reason. It's a controversial video they shared on social media. Welcome to 2 News at Noon. It's a 10-second video clip now shared thousands of times, and it's getting some strong negative backlash online.
It shows a group of students, some cheerleaders from Weber High, using a racial slur. Amy Ney has been following the story. And what's this all about?
Now, the Weber County School District has confirmed with me that the video that's gaining attention online is indeed featuring students from Weber High School, juniors and seniors, and three are cheerleaders at the high school. A statement issued by the district just a little while ago calls their conduct shocking and says they are now investigating an investigation they take seriously. A statement went on to say that this is something that is not acceptable, racism intended or not, any time. Here's what we can show you of the video that you can see was originally posted on Instagram and then shared on Twitter, Facebook, and beyond. We had to play this video in reverse as it is online. The students can be heard using an expletive and then a racial slur. The school district said that initial information suggests the students were using an app that actually played their uploaded video in reverse. And they were actually saying something along the lines of Surgeon Cuff, but when uploaded and then flipped, it's something very different. Now, part of the statement from Lane Finley, let's get back to that. It says, we are trying to determine when the video was made, where it was filmed, why the students would engage in such conduct, and how the clip ended up on social media. It also went on to say, we recognize many of our students could be affected by the video. Officials met with counselors and staff at the school this morning to provide resources to students who may be upset and emotionally affected. Now, the statement from Weber County School District also went on to say that sometimes kids do really stupid things without thinking. Well, this video clip online has really gained a lot of attention, as you mentioned, Ron and Mary. It has been retweeted thousands and thousands of times, many adding their own comments like disgusting or shameful. Even groups like Utahns Speak Out encouraging their thousands of followers to contact the school and voice a complaint. It's a story we're following for you here at 2 News.
Well, it's a tough story because we can't show their faces because right. they're minors, and we can't show air the video or the audio
right.
because it's a swear word.
It's been a hard one. A lot of people are really upset about this. It's yeah. getting more and more attention and, as they say, going viral.
Are they talking likely discipline when they get to the bottom of all of this?
Well, they say they are looking into it. A lot of people online are calling for some sort of disciplinary action, but a spokesperson for the school district said the individuals who they have been identified have expressed regret, and they say they are looking into this. So it's hard to say at this point what may come. But we'll have more from Pleasant View coming up tonight.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks a lot, Amy.
Yeah, appreciate that.
Why haven't you learned anything?
Today, a Florence One board member held a news conference to say the district needs new leadership.
Now, this all comes after longtime board member Glenn Odom resigned. Odom says it's because he moved out of the district that he represented. But as News 13's Kiana Patterson reports, the district points to racially insensitive emails it says Odom sent. Kiana.
That's right, Megan. And that last night's meeting was very tense here at the district office, and that board chair Barry Townsend admitted that he did have a meeting with vice chair and Glenn Odom before having another meeting with the district attorney, and this did not sit well with board member Alexis Pipkins.
I'm trying to determine what changes the thing that's been sent to all board members to one.
Board member Alexis Pipkins questioned why racially insensitive emails were forwarded from the superintendent's office only to Chairman Barry Townsend.
When this occurred, all board members should have been informed at the same time.
Pipkins shared the emails with News 13 from former board member Glenn Odom. It says in part, just don't send it to the darkies. Then Odom sent another email that was in jest about the darkies. Don't send it to H.D. Pipkins.
My name is Alexis D. Pipkins, but H is not my first initial, so there's no interpretation that the H was implying AD, and it means head darkening.
Townsend admits he and the vice chair had two meetings with Odom before sharing the information with the full board.
I'm confident that it was handled appropriately, legally, and professionally.
On Friday, Pipkins made several recommendations to the board, including a resolution to denounce Odom's actions, diversity training for the board, and a SLED investigation. He says if the recommendations are not met, he wants the chairman and superintendent to resign.
I will call for new leadership.
Superintendent Dr. Randy Bridges says he was the first African American to see the email.
So have I heard that term before? Absolutely. And others. Have they been associated to me? Absolutely. And others.
Bridges says the board has not reviewed the recommendations, but he wants to shift the focus back to the students.
Georgia. Police escorted a woman from a heated Muskogee County School Board meeting tonight. That meeting touched on a few hot-button issues, including racial slurs. News 3's Ashley Garrett was there for it all. She joins us now with a story you will see only on 3. Ashley.
Teresa, behind me is a look at that intense fallout from tonight's school board meeting. You're looking at video of the member of the Southern Anti-Racism Network, or SARN, shouting at school board chair Pat Hughley Green. Hughley Green wasn't the only person called out tonight. The SARN representative tells News 3 why she wants Superintendent David Lewis fired.
You shut up, you silly woman. You shut up, you silly woman. You have
Monday evening, Teresa Elamine, a member of the Southern Anti-Racism Network, or SARN, yelled at Pat Hughley Green, school board chair for Muskogee County. Elamine told News 3 she's displeased with Hughley Green because, in her opinion, Hughley Green tends to support actions that are not in the best interest of all children.
The zero tolerance policy is a racist policy, and the only people who will be affected by are black people.
Elamine also addressed former Reese Road Elementary School teacher Tammy Carnley using the N-word last month when talking to students. She's now asking that the zero tolerance policy for racial slurs proposed by board member John Thomas be taken off the table. She says Carnley is not to blame here.
When it comes to that poor teacher who didn't know any better, who was trying to teach tolerance to black kids, and she knew how offensive the N-word was. And she said, hey, what if you had been called? That was the way I heard the conversation.
Elamine is now calling on the termination of Superintendent David Lewis because he has not made it a requirement that teachers learn cultural sensitivity training. After Elamine was escorted out, board members proposed making this a requirement and also revising the proposed zero tolerance policy. Thomas says he's added a line.
For the purposes of this policy, zero tolerance will be defined as review for termination.
Hughley Green says the zero tolerance policy will be voted on next month. Hughley Green responded to the fallout between her and Elamine. She says everyone is entitled to have their opinions, and constructive criticism is welcome at the meetings. She also says part of her job includes running a meeting that is decent and in order. Teresa.
Things have happened. It's amazing when I talk to people and they say, man, I've been seeing folks protest and nothing has happened. When in reality, there are 40 new laws in 24 states. You would not have the number of police departments' body cameras. You now have city councils that are now looking at the police union contracts and rewording them. And so what do you say to the folks who are in the movement to keep them encouraged when other folks are saying nothing is happening, it's not improving, but also from your perspective, the what's next?
A wearable camera is increasingly a routine part of police officers' uniforms. That's despite a shortage of solid research on how the technology affects policing. Now, a large study in the nation's capital has turned up some unexpected findings. NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce has our report, and a warning, it contains audio from a violent police encounter that some may find disturbing.
Washington, D.C. has one of the biggest police forces in the country. All of its uniformed officers now wear cameras. They turn them on when they respond to incidents like this one. 911 callers said a woman was being attacked by her boyfriend, who had a knife. The video shows police officers urging the woman to move away as the boyfriend approaches, and then an officer fires. The man later died. It was Christmas Day. With cameras in D.C. capturing all kinds of police interactions, from intense ones like this to routine traffic stops, the question is, have the cameras changed officers' behavior? David Yocum runs a scientific research group in the city government called the Lab at D.C.
We need science rather than our speculations about it to try to answer and understand what impacts the cameras are having.
His team worked with police officials during the cameras' rollout to create two groups, cops randomly assigned to get cameras and cops who worked without cameras. There were more than 2,000 officers in all. The study period lasted about 7 months. Researcher Anita Ravishankar says they analyzed how cameras influenced all kinds of stuff: citizen complaints, use of force, whether cases were prosecuted.
We found essentially that we could not detect any statistically significant effect of the body-worn cameras.
In this city, the cameras had no discernible impact.
This is the most important empirical study on the impact of police body-worn cameras to date.
Harlan Yu is with Upturn, an organization that studies technology and civil rights issues. He says this study is very well done, and maybe cash-strapped police departments should think twice before buying cameras.
Because if cameras don't decrease use of force, don't decrease the number of misconduct complaints, and don't change officer behavior, then what are we adopting cameras for?
Some say cameras could have benefits that weren't captured by this study. D.C. Police Chief Peter Newsham says his department was surprised by the study's findings, but he worries people will come away thinking the cameras are worthless.
I don't think that this study suggests that at all.
He says, take that police shooting on Christmas. Some had questioned whether the man who was killed was actually holding a knife. Newsham says the video shows one in his hand.
And I think it's really important, you know, for legitimacy for the police department, which is really kind of the most important thing that we can have is our legitimacy.
That's why he says the cameras are here to stay. Nell Greenfield, Boyce, NPR News. How we stop the Black Panthers.
Ronald Reagan cooked up an answer. An FBI report from August has recently been discovered identifying Black identity extremists as a terrorist threat. Now, I read through this report, and it reads that the FBI assesses it is very likely Black identity extremist, or BIE, perceptions of police brutality against African Americans spurred an increase in premeditated, retaliatory, lethal violence against law enforcement and will very likely serve as justification for such violence. The FBI assess it is very likely this increase began following the August 9th, 2014 shooting of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. And the FBI assesses it is very likely incidents of alleged police abuse against African Americans since then have continued to feed the resurgence in ideologically motivated violent criminal activity within the BIE movement. So I want to read you more from this report, but I do want you to pay attention to some of the terminology that they're using here. And I tried to really emphasize it when I was speaking, but they say perceptions of police brutality, alleged police abuse, because apparently, according to the FBI, it's not that these people who are committing these acts of violence are mad about the racism. They're apparently being irrational in their reactions to the racism, according to the FBI.
And before you go on, Hannah, yeah. I just want to know for the record, there is no such thing as Black identity extremists.
No.
Well, there is now because it's in a piece of paper.
Mm.
Like they wrote it down. I mean, that's the sad truth is now they've created a category they can funnel people into.
Well, I mean, basically what they're doing is they're trying to relabel, you know, the BLM as something that it's not. That's what they're trying to do. I mean, it's pretty obvious, well, as you read throughout here, that it's all about like Black Lives Matter movement, but they just sort of like rephrased it so that they're not as explicit with how racist they're being. Now, they cite violence against police officers as a reason for this identification. They go into the FBI judges, very likely BIE perceptions of police brutality against African Americans have become organizing drivers for the BIE movement since 2014. I think that's another sort of, they're very clearly alluding to the BLM movement, resulting in a spike of BIEs intentionally targeting law enforcement with violence. And they say even though these five of these attacks occurred following controversial police shootings of African Americans by white police officers, the BIE or targeting of officers was not in every incident based on specific race. Now, they go into in great detail all of the violence against police officers, yet they don't do any sort of detail about violence against Black people. And they just continue and go into this. And the FBI has a pretty thorough record of being pretty racist. I mean, when you look at the counterintelligence programs that they used to carry out and still continue to carry out, they've always sort of like they targeted the Black Panthers, they targeted Martin Luther King, they targeted people during the Civil Rights Movement. This is not a new game for them.
So, you know, I've praised the FBI recently because I think they've done some good work in thwarting some potential domestic terrorism in the country, whether it was by Islamic radicals or others. But we got to keep it real on a couple of fronts. So during the Bush administration, the FBI was going to look into right-wing extremism. Not to say that it's all right-wingers who do it. Of course not. A lot of the folks who work at the FBI also are right-wing. Some, I'm sure, are left-wing, etc. Right? But it was to say there are actual groups like the Three Percenters, the Oath Keepers, and I'm not saying those guys, you know, I don't know the details of each one of those groups, but there are specific militias and groups who have agitated towards violence. So now that report was written in the Bush administration, it was released during the Obama administration, and the right wing flipped out. And so Rush Limbaugh, Fox News, they said, oh my God, they're targeting us. When the report didn't say that, they said these specific groups, we should make sure. And if you know the facts, you would know that that is very reasonable thing to do, because actually right-wing extremists in this country commit terrorism at twice the rate of Islamic radicals. Mm-hmm. Now, it's disproportionate per capita anyway, so it's not like you should ignore Islamic radicals. That's a definite problem. What we would ask the FBI to do is to treat all this fairly and then look to see what the real threats are. Now, is there a group that belongs in the now made up category of black identity extremists? There isn't. There is no self-proclaimed group, black group, that's going around saying we should consider violence. We shouldn't listen to the rules or laws of the country, as some of the right-wing groups say. They say if a judge makes an order, gives an order, some of the right-wing groups say it has no authority over me because of the Constitution and I don't pay taxes, etc. There is no real equivalent of that for black groups. This is just a way of saying, I don't know, separate mass shooters. And in those cases, like in Dallas, Louisiana, they did hit cops, but they were not part of organizations. In fact, the one in Dallas that killed the five officers was actively rejected from every black group he tried to join. So there's no movement. It's like saying, okay, how can I take the mass shooter in Vegas and somehow connect him to the mass shooter in Colorado and call it white identity extremists? That makes no sense,
right?
And so that's why this is, if they were trying to track a movement that was dangerous to cops, of course you should do that. But in this case, you invented a category that doesn't exist for a movement that doesn't exist. And of course, the real problem is, one, you're wasting resources, and don't do that because you've actually done some pretty good work otherwise. And number two is you're now saying, winking and nodding to some FBI agents, if they have that proclivity, just target black groups, whether they had anything to do with the violence or not.
Yeah, when you're talking about violence with black groups, it's often perpetrated against them. I mean, you look at these peaceful protests where police officers are throwing, you know, tear gas and like things on them and being extremely violent towards them. You know what I mean? It's not often the other way around. And this does sort of, you're right, it's like sort of like a wink and a nod. Okay, we're, you know, we said that the alt-right and people who identify as like white supremacists and things like that are a significant domestic terrorist threat. But also we'll add this in to make sure that we're like covering our bases and not pissing off enough people. Whereas like people within like the BLM movement and things like that often talk about peaceful protesting. Whereas on the flip side of that, Richard Spencer says that he's not afraid of violence and, you know, a bloody revolution to achieve what he wants. It's like, okay, it boggles my mind that, you know, the Bureau cannot look at those two, like, that compares them, right? It boggles my mind that they can compare them, and it boggles my mind that they don't see that and are not targeting that more effectively.
The only ideology, I mean, that I've seen is an ideology of equality, justice, and fairness. That's what people want. The danger, just by having this term out there, is you're going to funnel people who believe in equality, justice, and fairness just by where they are, what they're, the fact that they're at a protest and the FBI are looking at them, into this category that didn't exist until they wrote it down. I mean, the question is, it doesn't exist as a category because there's no one that fits it.
Right.
Just by virtue of they're trying to connect all these different cords that don't connect. But now people can be put into it. They're going to start with the guy who shot the police officers. And that is one person who committed a violent act. And they're just going to take anyone who's, it's going to get looser more and more loosely affiliated with an act of violence into a potential for an act of violence, which, you know, they seem to be pretty angry holding signs. Well, of course they're angry holding signs because they want equality, justice, and fairness, and they're not getting it. But they're not violent. And this gives the FBI an ability to classify them as such, and that's not fair.
It gives the FBI the ability to classify them as such, but it also gives just your everyday person the ability to classify them as such as well. When you think about how people, you know, run with the Islamic extremists and things like that, and the way that they perpetuate that term and perpetuate bigotry, now they have a new term to use against black people, and it's f***ed up.
Yeah. And look, we got all those protests in St. Louis, and our own reporter Jordan Charton and our cameraman Ty Bayless were arrested during those protests for just covering protests. Well, you know, stuff like this allows them to justify it and go, well, you know, anyone who's protesting who's of a black identity is a potential extremist So that's why we have this category. If you did it to white people and you said, okay, because some neo-Nazi did some violence in Charlottesville, any Tea Party protest is potential extremist, that would be outrageous and it would be unjustified. So let's spend our resources on actually addressing potential extremists and terrorists that might do us damage. The FBI has done some good work in that, about that in the past. Let's go back to that instead of going down this wrong road. Now I really understand what they mean when they say white power. White power, yeah. Come on. White power. It's white power. White power.
In advance of the speech in at a university in Florida of the white supremacist Richard Spencer, there were concerns about possible violence. I know that well over $500,000 was spent by the university for security. Would have been great if they were able to spend that on something else, but no, they have to spend it to protect the students from the violence that could erupt from a Nazi's speech. So they did that. He had his speech. We reported on it yesterday. It seems like he didn't really get to say much. It was mostly shouted out. Sorry, buddy, that's what free speech is like. But the concerns about possible violence were not misplaced. I mean, he is, of course, an integral part of the situation that developed in Charlottesville that resulted in the murder of a protester. Heather Heyer was killed there. And so the concern was that somebody else could possibly lose their life, possibly even more, when you put out a message designed to draw these extreme lunatics to you. And it turns out that those fears were well placed. Let's bring up this picture. You're going to see three individuals. Big fans of Richard Spencer there. And turns out that they tried to murder someone after attending his speech. So they were arrested. The arrest report said a silver Jeep containing those three men pulled up to a bus stop where protesters were sitting. One of the suspects started yelling Heil Hitler, in case this story and the narrative, the arc that it's going to take wasn't obvious enough for you.
Very seldom does anything good follow yelling Heil Hitler.
Not except when Jeffrey Lord got fired.
Okay.
That's a good point. It didn't leave anybody. But in this particular case, one of the individuals allegedly stepped out of the Jeep with a handgun. The two others egged him on to shoot them and kill them, talking about some of the protesters. And thankfully, nobody died because he doesn't know. He apparently has terrible aim. He fired at the protesters and missed, thankfully, then fled as a coward. And thankfully, they took down the license plate number of the Jeep and they were able to be found.
By the way, that's amazing because the shots have just been fired. Everybody's crazy and still they scribbled
still down
the license plate.
I don't understand how they did it, but they did it, thankfully. And what's so interesting is that when you go to before the speech, it turns out that some of those individuals who tried to murder protesters against Richard Spencer there were quite vocal about what they were looking to get. And there are things that they said don't necessarily line up with their actions. Now, Tyler Tenbrick, the one who actually fired the shot, said, "It appears that the only answer left is violence and nobody wants that." Well, maybe not nobody. It seems like you want that, actually. It seems like you brought a gun to this event looking to murder someone. And then one of the other individuals who was egging him on says, "Only people who think we're the violent ones causing violence are people who watch CNN. But then you were the guy shouting to murder the protesters." So that undercuts your message there a little bit. And William Fears went on to say, "We're starting to want to intimidate back. We don't want violence. We don't want harm. But at the end of the day, we're not opposed to defending ourselves." I don't know what defending means to him, but it probably doesn't mean getting out of your Jeep and firing a weapon, a firearm, at unarmed protesters.
And I think, you know, one thing about that, I think this happened after Charlottesville, and it's certainly evidence here, is that one thing to keep in mind is one of the ways that the white supremacist, white nationalist, and ethno-nationalist movements are recruiting, and one of the reasons they're growing so quickly, is that they're actually coming from these sort of men's rights advocacy spaces online. So mm-hmm. that's like Proud Boys and a bunch of other sort of groups like that. One is that they actually have a sub-arm for them that's sort of programmed for they call it a private militia. The name of it is the Fraternal Order supporter of the alt nights. It's like you can't even make fun of them sometimes, but they're being serious. I mean, they believe exactly that violence is the only answer, even though nobody wants it. It's one of the hallmarks of their constant refrains.
And they see themselves as the aggrieved party.
That's exactly right. And so, in a way, there's sort of this combination of this recruiting pool. And you see these white nationalists, white supremacists, and ethno nationalists actually coming and going to them and say, oh, well, this is largely the kinds of people that we could pull into our fold. And they're actually coming from what is essentially these young white men communities that are mostly, like you said, aggrieved. I mean, and as evidence of that, the leading social media accounts for white supremacy on Twitter had a 300% increase between the years of 2014 and 2016.
Wow.
And you know, that's the white genocide community is sort of how they define themselves broadly. And it is a reflection of the landscape. There's a reason why they're turning towards violence. They're actually pre-organized and predisposed to that. Much of what we saw in Charlottesville came from these communities. The fact that there was people there ready for violence, it wasn't just that there was a bunch of nasty white nationalists. They actually are training for this. Mm-hmm. That is what this fraternal order does.
Yeah.
And you know, just today, the Hilton in Arizona had to cancel a conference from VDARE, which is another leading white nationalist organization. This is the first year that they've ever tried to host a national conference and convening for white supremacists in sort of like a literally like a trade association kind of thing, because they are emboldened. And these are not outliers. These
and
are
worried that this would come from Donald Trump. I mean,
that's
as
right.
you said, it has been building.
Right.
But now they feel
like,
and you see this, by the way, all these reports come out of a person accosts someone in a convenience store or something, and they shout things like, this is Trump's America.
Yeah.
The world's a different place now. Trump himself said it last week. You know, we're going back to a different time. That's what we warned about. And it looks like a lot of people are very enthusiastic about it.
Hmm.
And by the way, I mean, there's been a little bit of reporting of this attempted murder. It seems like it would be picked up a little bit more considering the last big meeting did lead to the murder of a protester. But what I find a little bit odd is that the people on both on the right, you know, people like Tommy Lahren and the classic liberals who care so much about free speech rights, when a protester is almost gunned down by people who say at least that they're on your side, you may disagree that they're on your side, but they're claiming to be aligned with you. When they try to take the lives of people who are speaking out and protesting, acting politically, why then does your concern for free speech not come up? Why are there no tweets? Why are there no blogs? Or why are there no vlogs, no final thoughts? It's weird that there's suddenly silence from you when your side is attempting to gun down people they disagree with.
We need that bell. For the double standards.
We do need the
exactly.
bell.
There's a lot of double standards going around. I think that pretty much for the rest of Trump's term, at the very least, you'd hear a lot of bells going on around the country.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, October 21st, 2017. So I have been told. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have thoughts, observation, counter-racist suggestions. The number 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Couple quick things before we get to folks on the line. The COWS is listener-supported counter-racist radio. Invest if you think the program is constructive. Racism-notes.blogspot.com. Racism-notes.blogspot.com. Once you hit the blog, PayPal button is in the top right corner. If you are not into PayPal, drop us an email. We will get you a physical mailing address. Huge thanks to all the folks who have invested nearly a decade of counter-racist broadcasting. I hope we have helped non-white listeners get a more accurate understanding of what white supremacy racism is, how it works. Thanks also to folks who have gotten items from our wish list at Amazon.com under Gus T. Renegade, posted it on our Facebook page during the broadcast. Huge thanks to all the folks who have nabbed items from the list as well. Hope the broadcast has been and continues to be worthy of your time and energy. Also wanted to make sure I reminded folks, we were supposed to be broadcasting this past Wednesday. We were supposed to have Pam on the program, and she was not feeling well. We were supposed to have her on the program back during the summer, and I was having health problems. And now she is not feeling well. She told me to let folks know, and hopefully she will be doing better quickly so that we can get her on the program. Obviously, our first priority is her health and well-being. Lots of folks, when I posted this on the Facebook page and Twitter, lots of folks offered their well wishes and concern for Pam, hoping that she gets well and is feeling tremendous immediately. I will pass along folks' well wishes, and as soon as she is better, we will reschedule and get her back on the program. I know folks, myself as well, always enjoy hearing her views, thoughts on white supremacy, racism. Compensating, Dr. Niana Rasayan, he should be with us this coming Tuesday. It had been a while since we'd had him on the program. Actually, snickered, I was thinking yesterday evening, Dr. Rasayan was with us the night of the election. When Donald Trump was elected back in November 2016, he was on live as the results and what have you were coming in, just moments in Cal's history. But he'll be on the program this coming Tuesday. We'll review the Las Vegas shooting, get some of his thoughts around the anthem protests in the NFL, some of the other current events that are going on, some of his suggestions, things he would recommend black people be doing, paying attention to. But that'll be this coming Tuesday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. A couple quick things to touch on, and then we'll go ahead and get to callers, listeners. That word fair was used a number of times in some of our clips here in substitution for justice and correct treatment. This program, Compensatory Call-In, we are supposed to be paying attention to, being mindful about word use. That word in particular, in my view, one of those terms that is used consistently to support the system of white supremacy and equating whiteness or correct treatment and beauty and goodness and logic even with fair, with whiteness. It's one of those that we should be mindful of, and I would say try to limit its use in our vocabulary. Continuing, even since I did mention word use, I definitely would encourage folks to check out Crazy Talk, Stupid Talk, Neil Postman. That is our new book. We've only done two sessions, but I think people, if you appreciate, if you think Mr. Fuller might be onto something when he encourages, as a part of counter-racism science, being meticulous about word use, definitions, noting that some terms don't have definitions, and just the use of words is a primary tool of deception for racists, might want to check out Crazy Talk, Stupid Talk, Neil Postman. We'll be doing our third session next Friday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Wow. Really enjoying it. We're very early. You can catch up in the archives easy. Next. The situation in Georgia, where they were talking about having the zero tolerance policy for racial slurs. A listener, a Cows listener in the Georgia area, was familiar with and talking about this case, and they, you know, were seeing if other folks were familiar with this incident, or we have other Georgia listeners. This was a case that they had been focused on. I think it was a white teacher who had said nigger in the classroom, and it may have been that this white educator, the context that you heard in the news clip, that she was using this as a teaching moment about quote unquote tolerance and telling a classroom of black students, what if you were called nigger, to try to, I guess, use that as a comparison, perhaps, or an analogy. But I guess she was supposed to be disciplined in some manner. And they were saying that I guess some people didn't think that that was correct. And I think even it was a non-white person in the sound clip who was saying that this white teacher was ignorant, that she didn't know any better, and that maybe she shouldn't be subjected to some sort of punitive action. Right. I'm not sure. I would not ever for any reason be on the side of advocating or cheering for a white person who lost their job under suspicion that they were practicing racism. If that's what happened and she lost her job, oh, well, I'm sure she'll, you know, be OK. But if folks are familiar with that case. Again, it was around the zero tolerance policy, which I guess this was including staff, zero tolerance policy for racial slurs. So if you use a racial slur, you're going to be fired. And I think they changed the wording of the policy to a racial slur was grounds for a termination review. So you're not automatically going to be fired, but it'll be a review where you may be terminated. Folks are familiar, definitely appreciate thoughts on that. Next, also with education in schools, I thought it was really important. Justice, co-host here at the Cows, for years, when she was a young person, she would ask white guests, how do white people withhold constructive information? And I think even some of our other listeners have asked that question and posed that and the importance of that. That right there, that classroom example where they had a staff member, a white staff member, had been sending emails and saying, referring to black people as darkies. And then when this email came out, they didn't share this information with all of the council members. They were selective in who they passed this information to, and the other folks got it late. And you heard a black council member saying that he thought that that was incorrect. All of us should have got this information at the same time to evaluate and make a decision about whether this person should continue to be an educator. That right, and that sort of thing happens all the time. Just pointing that out in terms of that is another way that racism, white supremacy gets practiced, that it's not just the white person talking about darkies in this story that should be highlighted, white supremacy, racism. It's also withholding information from other black people, racism, white supremacy, or just withholding information, period. See, still not snitching on a white person practicing white supremacy. Next, they had that reenactment project in St. Louis, Missouri, reenacting the enslavement and sale of black people. And I was ambivalent about that piece for a number of reasons. I did think it was important. I think, you know, often when folks talk about enslavement of black people, a lot of times that'll get located to the South, kind of the same way with racism, white supremacy. And we don't think of enslavement of black people as being the global finance system of the day, if you will, that, you know, not to use a metaphor, but I mean, literally, that was the global finance system of the 19th, 18th, 17th century, even, you know, bigger than that, continues to be. But I think it's important to think it was not just in southern areas, coastal areas, Missouri selling niggers, New York selling niggers. So that was one reason I thought it was important. I don't know the constructive value of having another reenactment of enslaved black people. I mean, we had Django Unchained played in a lot of theaters. Goodbye, Uncle Tom is available on YouTube and other streaming sites. I think they just redid Roots last summer. I think they said they made it more gruesome. I still haven't seen it. They had The Birth of a Nation, which I also still haven't seen. It's lots and lots and lots and lots of slave pics, more than you could possibly imagine, dream of, think of. I mean, I guess, you know, there's something for historical value, and this is what it looked like in this particular part of the world, and, you know, someplace that we might not even associate with the enslavement of black people. I could kind of see the value in that, but also a big part of me just, I think white people enjoy seeing black people in explicit bondage. This is something that gets trotted out on a regular basis, in my view. And I just don't know if that's something that I want to see much more of. But yeah, speaking of bondage and Django Unchained, with all of the hoopla this past week around Harvey Weinstein, I guess it's been going on for about 2 weeks now. Lupita Nyong'o spoke out about how she, too, was subjected to his terrorist ways. And then Quentin Tarantino, honorary black person. I have heard people, I've even heard the late Dick Gregory stick up on behalf of Quentin Tarantino and saying he does great work and they love his products and what have you. Quentin Tarantino coming out and divulging, oh yeah, I knew about my buddy, Mr. Weinstein. They had, you know, worked together on so many films, Inglourious Basterds and Django Unchained. These all, you know, Weinstein productions. But he said, oh, yeah, I knew, you know, that he was doing these things, and I just didn't do anything. This was in the New York Times and widely reported. I wasn't surprised if you're already thinking of him as a racist white supremacist or at minimum a suspect, then it should be no surprise that one of his duties as a race soldier, of course, I don't snitch on other white people. Remember Joe Paterno, all that talk about the Nittany Lions, Penn State in their big game today? All that is forgot about, all that child raping that wasn't that long ago. All that is forgotten. It's just beat those Michigans, beat those Wolverines. Yeah, yeah, that's all the talk is. But all those folks said that they knew Jerry Sandusky was raping children. Joe Pa and everybody said they knew he was raping children. White people don't snitch on other white people. Same thing. And I'm very curious, all those folks that came out, talk bad about Bill Cosby, keep his news name in the news for the past, you know, 2-3 years and talking bad about him. And again, I don't know if he's guilty or innocent. He may have done everything he's accused of. It's not about that. It's just saying, if Mr. Weinstein apparently has been doing the same thing, is accused of doing some of the same things, then there should be equal treatment. And we should be having the same conversations about, well, what is Pulp Fiction's place in cinema history now? What is Django Unchained? All the films and projects that Weinstein and Tarantino touched, all of their projects should be in question the same way that they have questioned Cosby's legacy, right? Continuing. Last thing I'll, in fact, I will just stop right there. Folks, if we do have listeners in the Georgia area who have any commentary about the school situation, that would be grand, because we did have listeners down there who were following that situation closely and were very pleased that the white female educator, that she was let go, that she was disciplined with their no tolerance policy. Anyway, number again, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Before I get to the callers, remind folks, if you could take 5 minutes to share whatever thoughts that you have. That way everybody gets an opportunity to share. If you have additional comments that you want to share, just make sure everybody gets at least one chance to speak, and then you can add whatever additional comments, sentences you want to get in. Also, for this broadcast exclusively, if we could not use metaphors, that is one thing I have seen consistently. Racists, white supremacists, they will practice racism by comparing two different entities that are not equivalent at all, but they will insist, oh yeah, these two things are alike. They're exactly alike. They're very similar. It's almost the exact same thing. They will insist that that is a major tool of deception, racism. Victims, non-white people like Gus T, we have been exposed to this for a number of years, and many of us, we are still learning, still trying to come to a conclusion. And as a result, sometimes we're still just trying to process how we think about this information. So sometimes we will employ a metaphor to make up, to compensate for our lack of logic, or where we're just still thinking, still processing. And sometimes that just adds to the confusion. I would encourage folks, be mindful, be alert. Crazy talk, stupid talk emphasizes this point a lot, but just be mindful when people begin to use metaphors, because sometimes, man, it is not logical at all. It's not accurate at all. And if you ask enough questions, you'll see that it just doesn't make sense. That's it. Folks have commentary they would like to share. Again, be mindful of the background noise. Thank you kindly. If you have a hand up, first few folks that dialed in, a line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Greetings, everybody. I wasn't sure if the same clip about, I'm mixing up the states, but the one that Gus just spoke about where they did the reenactment, if that was the same one where they were talking about the vaults. Gus, is that the same clip?
Correct. That's all in St. Louis.
Okay, all in the same clip. Okay. I don't think that the relics just disappeared. I think they might have been sold. I don't think that, like, white people like that kind of stuff. And with so many other so-called artifacts, they show up later in people's personal collections. Who knows what was there? So I think the way that they, like, in listening to the way that that white male was just dismissing things, I would question whether or not they just disappeared. It took them way too long to say that the vaults were the places that enslaved African people were kept. I mean, that's an arbitrary point, but I didn't know that that's what a vault was until they finally said that. For the BIE, what is it? The Black Identity Extremists. Okay, that's what that means. That right in the beginning, they're talking, and I'm paraphrasing, but they say that they're trying to say, well, it's not real, it's made up. And then it's like, well, no, it is real because they wrote it down. And by writing it down, made it real. And then they specifically say that they created categories. And I'll just say the book club, Crazy Talk, Stupid Talk, or Stupid Talk, Crazy Talk. And also, I mean, like, that's power, to be able to make up something and make it real and make it so just because you said so. And that's what racist, that's what white supremacy is, and that's what racists do. I think that the point is, like, and I've said this before, I don't, you know, for me, it's just the facts point to this, that is the direction, is the race war, as it was written in, like, the Rising Tide Against Color or whatnot, that's essentially what they see. And unfortunately, it's like, it's not our game really to say. If someone comes and performs violence against you, you really only have a couple of options. And since this is their, oh, I'm sorry, that was a metaphor, not game. We're not the ones creating this system. So we are in a position of reacting to it. We haven't moved beyond reacting to it to creating what we want it to be. And I do foresee racist white people, all the steps that they have taken are to have a race war. That's the point of what I'm trying to say. And then white genocide community, didn't even know that was like a thing, Welsing moment. And I just, their training, which just further reemphasizes the other point. I don't know what, you know, we're supposed to do or anything, like what we should do, everyone, VGQ, whatever. But I do think that is the ultimate point. Thank you.
Appreciate that, Emmy. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Awesome. This is Ken Steele, and I'm reporting from, I believe I'm in San Dimas, California. And I just wanted to say this week, first, I read an amusing article on a website called the National Review. And the National Review is a suspected white supremacist publication that is branded as a conservative outlet. And in this National Review, there's an article. It is titled, just a second here. It's titled something of the sort of a white minstrel show. Now, there was a line in the article that made me laugh particularly hard. It said that before I get to the line, I just want to say that the article is a critique of the, I guess, so-called conservatives that are affiliated with Donald Trump or hardcore Donald Trump support. and it is, I guess, a rebuke of the what they call the right wing or the GOP's embrace of, I guess, anti-intellectualism. And what he kind of, I guess, is drawing parallels to with problems in black representation in media. So the author kind of compares all of the negative stereotypes that were perpetuated by specifically who he identifies as Ice Cube and Ice-T about and says that, you know, that this was the standard of blackness. And then now fast forward that the standard of whiteness is now becoming affiliated with how Trump behaves. And the line that really caught my attention was that the author suggested that there should be a Moynihan report for conservative commentators. So, you know, that was something that really did catch my attention. But another thing that really caught my attention this week was the government basically introduced everybody to the operations in Africa. I believe there was a report that said Senator Lindsey Graham said that I guess the next war is in Africa. And, you know, the, I guess, Gold Star soldier or family, this soldier, he was killed in a mission that took place in Niger. And, you know, what is the United States doing in there? Well, I saw a video released by Now This, which is, I guess, what they would term as a left-leaning or left-wing or liberal news outlet on the internet. And they basically had a white supremacist soldier or a suspected white supremacist race soldier on there casually explaining why the United States special forces are being dispatched all over in virtually every single country on the continent of Africa. And, you know, he was giving his very, you know, logical sounding reasons. And one line that really caught my attention was that placing special forces in Africa, in these rural areas, offers a great, quote, return on investment. And, you know, that was something that was really interesting. And then I was also reminded of another report that I read where all of these private security companies have been hiring former child soldiers from West Africa, places like Burkina Faso Sierra Leone, my apologies. But yeah, they're hiring former child soldiers for, I guess, pennies on the dollar. I guess $200 a month was the rate that I read, to go off in all of these various proxy wars that the United States is going on. And they're fighting on behalf of these private military companies, and they're offering all of the security services that that are being credited to companies like Blackwater and G4S and all of these other private military companies. And I don't know, the United States operations in Africa are becoming way, way, way more involved, and they are, I guess, branding this as the next frontier. So I guess that's my report for this week. I guess I'll have some comments later. I'll mute my line at this time. Thank you so much.
Yes, sir, Mr. Steele. Soldier's name was Sergeant David Johnson, that I guess did become a part of the controversy this week and the back and forths and accusations that President Trump did not remember Mr. Johnson's name, Sergeant Johnson's name, but Mr. Johnson. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you had commentary, line should be open. Proceed. Folks are spectating when they call in with hands up and are still kicking back and waiting. I don't know if they're waiting for other folks to share a comment or two. While folks are taking their time to get their thoughts together, I did want to make sure I mentioned for Black Talk Radio Network founder, Scotty Reed, that segment on the use of prisoners to fight the wildfires in California, where there have been fatalities. I'm talking about the folks fighting the fires have died. Some of even prisoners have died fighting the fires. I think he would certainly say that that definitely qualifies as enslavement. If you have to go out and battle fires in the hopes of getting time off for good behavior, or maybe that will qualify you for access to get a little better time with your offspring for visitation. For sure. For sure. The folks who dialed in with a hand up, y'all have commentary as well.
Can I be heard?
Yes. Greetings, Princess.
Good evening. Hi, Gus. Good evening to the callers. I just wanted to share a little bit of an update on my workplace situation, just very briefly. It's not going to be long or anything. Is that okay?
Oh, for sure. Let's proceed. Let's hear it.
Okay. Well, I did want to say that my former, now former store manager, she sent me a text earlier basically indicating that she was hoping that she would have been able to see me yesterday, although she knew that she had already scheduled me off until tomorrow. But nonetheless, she was wishing me the best of luck and all this other stuff. And the whole debacle with my schedule this week was the fact that I was looking to, you know, put in vacation time because I was looking at possibly actually going away on vacation. She kind of did it in a terroristic fashion because she didn't release the schedule, so that way I would know what days I would have until the very last minute when she found out that she was going to be leaving the store. But because I hadn't been in all week, she had only told me last week that she was only going to be able to afford to give me 4 days, which it really, I just would have felt that it wouldn't have been beneficial for me to go because I had initially put in for about a week. But she didn't tell me whether or not it was approved. And I would just say overall, I don't know if anybody has on these jobs experience, these managers or whatnot, or companies and stuff, messing with people's PTO time, just any time that they might want to put in. Does anybody experience or have issues with being able to get time approved off on days that you request for? I mean, do you have to go through a lot of red tape in order to get time off? Is that something that they use against Black people on the job nowadays or something? So that was my first question. And I was going to say, as far as this whole bit about the military officer that was killed in action somewhere fighting other Black people, I had listened to a program. It was my first time listening to it, the show, the Carl Nelson show. and I guess it was shortly after the shooting in Las Vegas. It was some guy on there with the host, I guess. I don't know whether he sounded like he was probably ex-military. He was a black male, ex-Marine. Nonetheless, he was just going on and on about his experience overall in the military and the service and, you know, how he's networked with a lot of people in law enforcement and stuff. And he touched on pretty much, I guess, what Ken Steele was saying as far as people, you know, falling for the Alex Jones type conspiracy theory traps. But I think one thing that left me a little bit perturbed with him was the fact that he has all of this knowledge and intel on, you know, military training, tactical training, and all this stuff, weaponry and whatnot. And what does that do to help the community as far as, well, what we ideally say is the community? I mean, why doesn't that information translate to, you know, back to black people, so that way we know how to defend ourselves? Because it seems like the other lady was saying earlier, you know, they're training, they're doing what they can, and, you know, to protect themselves. And it just seems like we, you know, we join the military, we go into the armed forces and stuff, and we learn how to kill each other. And we come back home, and it's just, you know, it's almost like it's bragging rights. So that's all I had a question for.
Oh, right on. Appreciate that, Princess. Down in Florida, state of emergency. My quick response to the two questions about the PTO, the whole time I was thinking, wow, they should have a program where black people can talk about their problems with workplace racism. In terms of PTO specifically, I think Thomas in New York has discussed that before, where he was having all types of problems and given lots of rigmarole around vacation time that he put in well in advance. And I think what worked to his advantage was going right to policy and procedure in the specific page and paragraph where it talked about PTO and doing exactly what was prescribed in policy and procedure. And that seemed to work flawlessly for him. But absolutely, that seems to be a pattern to make it difficult for black people even to get time away from work, or not giving you the days that you wanted, or giving it to you and then taking it back. Absolutely. In terms of passing on training from the military or armed services, I think some black people did do that. Geronimo Pratt, Jackie Robinson even, did do that. They went and picked up those skills and then shared that with black people stateside. Once they were out of the service, he joined the Black Panther Party to do exactly that. And he was labeled a black identity extremist in his day and ended up being in prison for more than 25 years. So white people even seem to do a pretty good job of making sure that that sort of thing happens on a very limited basis, if at all. Those would be my two responses to the questions. Other folks can answer them as we proceed. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. Back-to-back Florida callers.
That's right. Greetings, everyone. Also, I would say also perhaps the Deacons of Defense in the South, a lot of those guys were ex-military individuals who also used those skills to defend other black people in the areas where they were located at. Maybe also, what was the black male, I can't think of his name, I'm so bad with names, along with his wife, there was a book that he wrote, autobiography he wrote.
Robert F. Williams?
On the cover. Yes. Yes. I think he was in the military, too, at one time or another. And if it wasn't just him, if it wasn't only him, I think a lot of the black males who were organized with him were ex-military. So there are a lot of periods in time in our history in this part of the world where black males who had some military training and experience, once they came out of the military, they almost had to utilize racism. White supremacy was so obvious that you just had to keep a gun around the house. You know, keep a gun around the house. And Angela Davis talks about her father, who constantly had guns around the house, you know, on a daily basis, ready and willing and able, prepared to defend himself and his family. I am in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, because I, for the first time since I actually played in the game, visited the college that I went to, Langston University, and visited what the event that's called Homecoming. First time I've been here as a on this particular day since I played back in 1978. Not for any celebratory purposes, specifically mainly for the standpoint to try to get my offspring up here. So I established a relationship with the coaching staff. I'm talking about to utilize his athletic ability to get a college diploma. And one thing I noticed on campus was all of the white security people, personnel, and enforcement officials. And we're talking about a historical black college. I can recall when I was a student on campus that it'd be almost unheard of to have a white person as a enforcement official. Not saying that hanging around enforcement officials, whether they're white or non-white, is a general practice that one should be doing. But with a white person that's also an enforcement official, we definitely know about the calamities that occur under those circumstances. That's an obvious observation that I had. Last but not least, the deceased, sadly to say, black male, the non-commissioned officer was killed in action. He actually grew up in the Miami Gardens area, and I'm pretty sure that he grew up within walking distance of me. You know, not too far away from me. He went to the same a lot of the same schools that my son went to. Some information to give everybody that he was pretty. Also, the congresswoman, last but not least, the congresswoman who mentioned about Mr. Trump's comments, Frederica Wilson, is also a former Miami-Dade County public school teacher and principal who eventually went into professional politics and became a congressperson. And she's very well known down here. Of course, people know her as the female lady with the cowboy hats. But she's a longtime teacher down here in Miami-Dade County. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Appreciate that, retired firefighter, Florida state of emergency. With those security at the college sporting events, I learned about this when they had the intense coverage of Florida State and Jameis Winston, the allegations that he had allegedly raped a white woman, that security at those college sporting events, particularly Division I schools, is huge business. I'm sure it might be a little bit smaller once you get down to smaller schools or HBCUs, historically black colleges, and what have you, but it is big business. So I'm sure if there's any type of significant money to be made from doing the security at those games up in Oklahoma, I could easily see white saying, oh yeah, we're going to take over this too. Yeah, we'll go up to the black folks' college and do the security and make whatever money can be made from during the security. Other folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up, comment to be made, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Greetings to you, the host, the callers, and the listeners. This is Mhandisi. I wanted to first say to the Africans that you're going to have to be black first. Some people say that terminology, black first. You have to only have black allies. There has to be a Pan-Africa. And the sooner you make alliance with the African-Americans, the black people over here, the fewer people that will die there on the African continent. The other thing I wanted to say was that for the black speakers, there's a lot of black speakers on YouTube. The speakers, we need not to say at all that there are good white people. That is absolute confusion. It is causing people to die. It is causing many of us to be killed and murdered. There are no good white people, and there should be no black speaker ever saying that at all. It's counterproductive. And I also wanted to say that every day I research white people going extinct. They put it on YouTube. They put it on Google. They put it on a lot of different web sites, and they put it on a lot of different news outlets. I research white people going extinct every single day. Every single day, there is something else that gets updated. And then what happened was they eventually changed the terminology. Instead of saying white extinction or white people going extinct, instead of that being the title that they put this information in, they started putting it under white genocide. So I researched that every single day. I researched white genocide every single day, and I think that black people should research that every single day. Research it, see what these white people are talking about. You'll find out a lot of good information. You also find out how to solve this problem a lot quicker. And the last thing that I wanted to say is that for the black people here in America, that we should continue with the narrative that we are native here, in that we are the first Americans and nobody else has that claim, and everybody else is invaders. We are the first Americans. This is our land. The second thing is that we are African. Africa is also our land. Africa is our people, and we have to be Pan-African. Thank you.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Peace, Gus, and all listeners. Gus, I just wanted to thank you again for this, for the constructive sound clip tonight and for this outlet in general, for allowing us to listen to the compilation you put together and allowing us to express ourselves. So thank you. And before I mute, I just kind of wanted to touch back. A sister spoke. She was one of the first, and she was saying something that she feels that racists are trying to start a race war. And all I just wanted to say is it's already begun. And peace, y'all.
Much obliged. Absolutely. Absolutely. Racism, white supremacy is war against black people. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you had commentary you wanted to share, line should be open. Proceed. Did we miss folks? It seemed there were hands up of people that had not shared at all. Did we miss anybody? Anybody have a hand up that we haven't heard from?
Have you heard?
Thomas in New York, greetings.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to all the callers. I'm still en route to work. I was only able to hear two clips. The clip about the woman prisoners was terrible. They're getting like $40 a month to put out fires. And I've never seen a woman firefighter before. Other than like a secretarial position, Never seen one like put on a uniform and go in a house. So for them to take these women prisoners and throw them into the line of fire is just showing you how they feel about them. The other clip I heard, and I kind of heard it in the middle, and I'm hoping I took it out of context because it just kept reeking of white validation. But I heard a white woman, I believe in the St. Louis area, talking about like they had a mock draft. Was that what I heard, or was I hearing, taking it out of context?
They were having a reenactment of a slave sale in St. Louis, because this was, I guess, one of the popular areas where they were trafficking in flesh peddling. And so they wanted to have this be historically accurate for what happened in the St. Louis area. So they did some sort of 15-minute filming.
And she said that she had a white man asking her to hop on one leg. And
right.
She was, yeah, yeah. See, that's white validation right there. Why in 2017 would you be having a draft, a mock slave draft or whatever you would call it, unless you want to somehow get some type of empathy from white people? Like, what purpose does that serve to the black people? It doesn't. It just puts us right back into that same mindset. Now this week I was traumatized.
Well, before you get to this week, just to throw in really quick, because I had questions about that segment as well. The black female who was involved with the project, she said she felt it was important to get all of this documented just for historical accuracy. This did happen, and a lot of people weren't aware that this happened, so she felt like it would be important. People could put it in context, particularly for St. Louis with everything that's happened there over the last 3-4 years, to put that in context for the history of that region. That was her reason for saying that we should do it, and not to try to lie about it or cover up that this happened.
Well, if I'm not mistaken, there's documented proof that this happened, right?
Right, but she said a lot of people didn't know about it.
Well, that's their fault. You still don't go do a mock draft. Like, I mean, you didn't do that for the black people. Especially if you did it for the black people, you wouldn't have no white people standing there asking you to hop on one leg. Like, what are they there for? If you're trying to educate your people, you don't need to have them there. I just don't agree with it. But I was traumatized twice this week, and it's along the same lines. I finally got a chance to see the Nate Turner Birth of a Nation movie, and terrible, horrible. Wish I never saw it. 12 Years a Slave was better. That should put it in any type of context. Then I turned around the next day and I see the girl crying over the casket with her baby next to her. And it was like the same feeling as I saw when I saw those people hanging at the end of the movie. My problem with the movie is that, well, I won't even get into that right now, but that just really, you know, affected me. I was very angry when I saw that, and I'm walking into the plantation, so I will have to mute my line for now until I punch in and stuff.
Wow. Nate Parker's Birth of a Nation. Wow. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you had commentary, if we've not heard from you, feel free. Other folks we've not heard from. Yes, sir.
Oh, yeah. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. I think that was the clip of the, I think that was the cheerleaders that was saying, I think they was saying nigger and something else. Like that part at the end where they were saying, where you know, we can't really reveal the images or the identity, you know, the names of the students, I guess, because they're minors. But there is, I think there was a video showing like their faces, but I don't know what their names are. And there's still been plenty of these incidents of these young white kids engaging in practicing racism. And, you know, I think when you had mentioned that code they have where, you know, they don't snitch on each other, that is very, very widespread, and that is very factual. Next, to speak on the how is Dan down here with Richard Spencer, yeah, I did hear on, like, around Friday that those three guys had stopped to, I guess, practice racism and provoke some protesters. I guess they was walking toward a bus stop. And just, like, for them to do that just shows how, you know, how large the arrogance is, because it was so many, like, it was hard for me to get to work, at least, like, toward Wednesday through Friday, because they had blocked off a like a major, like, street or highway to where the Hilton hotel is across the street from the Phillips Center. And it was like, they say maybe at least 400-500 like law enforcement vehicles just lined up in a row. So, you know, they had no problem catching them. But I guess they thought they would be able to do it and, you know, not be caught, I guess. But the like the response, I guess I can say VGQ, they made sure they got the black males like hugging on the person wearing a Nazi or a swastika on his shirt. And the same guy got punched in the jaw or whatever. But mainly the like the speaking event, I seen it with Richard Spencer, like when he first came out or whatever, they immediately started to like shout him down or whatever. And, you know, something about this I thought that was non-constructive, because I think racism was being practiced and, you know, on the point on the side where people would think black people would be against, you know, white supremacy or whatever. But you have white people who are supposed to be the quote unquote allies, that, you know, they are telling them to stand up at a certain time, and in unison, you know, they chant this Spencer go home thing. And then, you know, they kept on doing this. And, you know, he says, well, I'm not going home. And, you know, he started calling them children. And he says, you know, when you ready to think for your, he says, are you ready to think for yourself? And there was like a, like, if I could share this, it was very interesting. It was one question where somebody asked him, you know, what's the cutoff for white? Like, somebody asked him again. And that same guy that was at Auburn, he got on that. He started saying something about, you know, they love to ask this question. There's no such thing as white enough. So she, you know, it was two questions she asked, and he never, you know, Richard never answered that second question about what's white enough. And, you know, another person, he had used this giant metaphor. He went, because he asked them a question, they turned and started asking him questions. So the dude was like, well, you know, I'm going to just stick to what I usually say. And I was asking you questions, sir. Can you answer my question? He says, no, it just doesn't. And he got, like, kind of agitated. Like, you know, he got real upset. And he was saying, no, that's not the way it works. Even though it was the Q&A session. So this guy that was asking the question, now he used a metaphor, and he says, do you go in a pizza with a pizza and ask them would they like to buy a pizza? Or, you know, do you sell a pizza? It was so confusing, man. Like, but I kind of got what he was saying, but I started laughing when he used that metaphor, man. But it was very abstract when he mentioned that, and it didn't seem like it was very constructive for people to learn more about the system of racism. And that was pretty much the sum up of that speaking engagement. And that's all I have for now. Thank you.
Epic. Epic. I'm going to have to write that one down. Do you go to Pizza Hut and ask them if they want a pizza? Hall of Fame on the metaphors list. Wow. Wow. And sometimes you can do that. That will totally change the conversation, because when you throw out a metaphor like that and you cause confusion, it's no telling where that can lead. People can end up just taking their whole time like, wait a minute. We go to what? And just trying to figure out what the metaphor means, as opposed to, we were talking about what is the cutoff point for white people not going to Pizza Hut? Man. Other folks who dialed in, if you have a question, comment, we haven't heard from you. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings to you guys, to all the other callers and listeners. I had a couple of things. Great program as usual. One of the clips that you played, there was the one specifically on the enslaved women prisoner firefighters. I just say enslaved firefighters. There was a term they used during the segment where they called the camp a conservation camp. And I'm like, no, it's a concentration camp. They just changed the word concentration to conservation, because when you listen to the women speak about the different quote unquote benefits of seeing their children in an environment that's not prison-like and all of these other little so-called benefits that they get for risking their lives, it sounds to me like a Jewish concentration camp during Nazi Germany. So I think that term conservation camp is used on purpose. And I think it's a play on words in the system of white supremacy in order to kind of soften the thought process regarding the use of conservation versus a concentration camp, because that's exactly what it is. A couple of things that I saw, articles I came across that I found quite interesting as far as just getting a richer understanding of the system of white supremacy. They had an article at futurism.com where they said they had a study done, and they found out that 1 in 6 deaths worldwide is caused by pollution, or was caused by pollution in the year 2015. So to me, that's just population control, the system of white supremacy. The vast majority of areas where pollution is concentrated are areas where black people are specifically, and non-white people in general. So the vast majority of those 1 in 6 death numbers are going to be black people and non-white people. To me, that's a great numerical example of how the system of white supremacy works. Regarding the sex scandal situation, found an article from Fox, Lying Like a Fox News, where they said that Bill O'Reilly's contract was renewed after he had a $32 million settlement. We always talk about white people who practice racism, criminality, that they don't lose their jobs, they get transferred, or they get a reward. His reward is that he got his job back after paying $32 million. So this is how the system works when it comes to white supremacy and white people, and the way that they collectively work together to make sure that they turn out fine, regardless of how they behave. There was another article that came out by Science Alert that stated, it says, the title says it all. There's a big problem skewing neuroscience. We're not all white and middle class. And in the article, they say that the entire process of neurological sciences has been tainted the same way, where all of the testing that they do it based on middle class white people for the most part. So any non-white people involved in their testing or anything of that nature are not going to get accurate information simply because they're not white. And essentially the whole system is linked to servicing white people only. So I found that to be quite fascinating. And also they had an article on IndieWire that said Roman Polanski, the child rapist extraordinaire who escaped criminal charges in the States, is also accused of molesting a 10-year-old in 1975. So there again, the system of white supremacy is just all about raping children, raping men, raping women. Doesn't matter. Rape animals. It's just rape and getting away with it, pretty much, for the most part. Very rarely do we get any true justice. And again, like you said, that word fair is quite nauseating to me, just the whole concept of the word fair. Now when I hear it, it just really, really just really agitates me to hear that term. So I completely agree with Neely Fuller. I agree with you as well. And I will say, Crazy Talk, Stupid Talk is a book that I think as many listeners as possible should get in on. It's a fascinating read, and I think it'll help expand our consciousness as far as understanding the proper use of words and actually what words that we shouldn't be using. Thank you, and I'll mute my line.
For sure. Appreciate that, Roz. We had a caller who wrote in during, since we came live on the air this evening. They asked, just in general, this wasn't a princess or anybody else who touched on workplace racism. They just asked if you call in to, like, update your situation, right? To kind of give us, if you can, a synopsis of the previous incident, because sometimes people either missed the previous program, or we have people that are victims of racism, so maybe their memory is not as great as we would like it to be, and they just forgot. If you could maybe give us a quick synopsis, if you're giving an update, that way folks are kind of at least all together. They all have enough pertinent information to adequately understand the update that's being given. I'll try to prompt about that as well, and I try and include a update to the best of my memory when people call in to do so. Other folks that we have not heard from at all, or if you think you have commentary you might want to share before we sign off, the number 641-715-3640 and the code 564-943 pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. That just as we go, I'm just passing commentary. Did folks see the articles this week, the reports they had about the love letters that were being released from former President Barack Obama to Cowbell, some white chick from way, way back years and years and years ago? I just thought that was mildly significant for the week as well. Other folks that we haven't heard from, if you had commentary, line should be open. Proceed.
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. Good evening, everyone. I had not heard about that, Gus, but I would be interested in finding out. I'll be looking for those that story. This is an article from the New York Times. Pennsylvania Republican congressman may soon be voted out of office because the opiate card is being played. And it's now being used strategically in politics, including what are you doing to save white people relative to the opiate epidemic. Apparently, this Congressman Tom Marino is a betrayer of white people because he championed a law that his critics say make it easier for opiates to enter the black, quote unquote, black market. So Congressman Marino withdrew as President Trump's nomination for drug czar on Tuesday after reports that the pharmaceutical industry contributed close to $100,000 to his campaign while he shepherded a law making opiates more easily available in the midst of a national crisis. So one of his critics asked, does he even care about his people? And the area, and Donald Trump was quoted as saying that we're looking into Tom, that's the congressman's name, and that he would be making a major announcement, Donald Trump, on the subject next week. So I see this opiate crisis as a more clarification about how the system behaves comparing white people to black people in our struggle with anything. The final contribution I'd like to make is from the New York Times business section, Living on a Borrowed Dime. There's a picture of a black female on the front page of the section. She's sitting in a wheelchair looking very serious and forlorn. And so the article subtitle is Credit Card Debt Soars Again and the Banks Are Raking It In. And an article points out that the woman on the cover is a retired telephone operator who relies on at least a dozen credit cards to make ends meet. and that her prescriptions go on one credit card, groceries go on another credit card, and so on. And so the article points out further that she's on Social Security as her only income and is only able to make minimum payments on her credit card. The problem with this is that it's a risky strategy for this woman, but the banks, the banksters, this is a magnificent strategy for them at this time, because the largest banks, Bank of America, J.P. Morgan, Chase, Citigroup, who, oh, by the way, made $4 billion from this mechanism, from their credit card business between July and September. July and September, $4 billion. And this is precipitated by rolling over total balances from month to month, paying only the minimum balance. So this is the outstanding credit card debt balances hit a record $1 trillion this year, and it's only October. So I'm just saying that something that I would like to continue to recommend, what I heard Minister Louis Farrakhan say, as he has delineated as a counter strategy against our oppression, which is to redistribute the pain by trying your best to manage your finances, given the system of race and white supremacy juggernaut. It's let's try to minimize the system's impact on us in terms of one of the areas of, as Mr. Floyd calls, one of the areas is economics. So let's try to at least consider that they're benefiting wildly on some of the things that we're struggling with financially. Thank you for listening.
Indeed. Other folks that we have missed completely, folks have a hand up and we've not heard from you at all, you should go ahead and speak now. Folks who dialed in, Maurice.
I can't swear, like, a lot of black people are.
I don't know if that's background noise or if they're trying to speak with us. If you have a hand up, if you had commentary, if we haven't heard from you at all, speak now. Did we get everybody? Soon we might have gotten everybody. I'll look out for other folks if you try and get a hand in the last 30 minutes or so before we get to the end of the broadcast. If you have additional commentary you would like to share, number again, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. Did other folks have additional comments they wanted to get in before I get share a thought or two?
Yes, I did. Thanks for allowing me to speak again, Gus. I had two comments about the Harvey Weinstein situation, because I just had like two observations. One was that the sheer numbers of women coming out against Harvey Weinstein, especially white women, to me shows how the system of white supremacy works against less powerful whites. But it also shows how they protect each other, because this should have come out decades ago. If there was any sort of equitable treatment in the system, but he's been allowed to just recklessly rape and fondle and molest people for decades, and no one has said a word. And to me, it just shows how that hierarchy of white supremacy works, as far as more powerful whites against less powerful whites, and the fact that whites collectively, whether they're more or less powerful, will protect the more powerful whites, regardless of what is done to them. That was one observation. The other one I actually expressed on my radio show, which was the fact that Harvey Weinstein, I just found the timing of this exposure to be very significant, because he was not exposed as a sexual terrorist until after the Khalif Browder documentary. I have a feeling, just knowing the system of white supremacy, him being a white man and a so-called white Jewish man, in that system of white supremacy functioning in entertainment, ultimately he, to me, violated the code of white supremacy, where you're not supposed to allow any sort of constructive dialogue when it comes to the mistreatment of Black people. So I found it very telling that it was after the Khalif brought a documentary. During that documentary, he made multiple announcements that him and Jay-Z will be working on other counter-racist material down the road. And I believe that this was exposed now, like you always talk about, and we've talked about white people holding information until it's advantageous for them to utilize it, as far as if they have any negative or criminal information about a person, that they'll hold on to it. And whenever it's advantageous for them to release that information in order to stop them from doing something that they want to stop them from doing, they'll release it. And I just found it very telling that it was after the Khalif Browder documentary, the further announcements of other counter-racist material coming down the road. And in that context, all of a sudden, he's just this sexual terrorist where everybody's coming out against him. So those are my two observations. Thank you, and I'll meet my line.
Interesting. They didn't do him with the Nate Parker treatment, where they were sabotaging right when the project was coming out. They really wanted to make sure people were questioning whether or not they wanted to even watch the Khalif Browder project from earlier this year. But that is interesting to ponder on. Other folks have additional comments that they wanted to make sure they got in? Folks that we missed or folks that had a hand up?
Have you heard?
Yes, sir. Thomas in New York.
Yes, sir. Yeah, I wanted to say something, man. I listened to Kim Steele's commentary last week. And he was talking about people and conspiracy theories. And I just want to say I disagree under the premise that when you go back and look at everything that's happened to us as a people, it's been a conspiracy. You know, when you go back, you could pretty much see where they laid it out and when it started. And you know, and it's like, man, how did we miss that? So everything they do to us is a conspiracy. They're all conspiring. And also, if you go to court and you're charged with conspiracy, that's one of the worst things you want to get charged with. So it's very real. It's not something at stake to me, a conspiracy. It's just another way of looking at things. So I just wanted to say that. I do agree with Roz, though, that's definitely, I believe, the reason why he's being exposed. Who knows what other projects they have coming down the line. And one of the first things that happened was Jay-Z wanted to get the rights to the projects they had together that they've been working on. And in order to do that, he had to buy back his percentage of that company that he owned into. Or you know, they, you know, whatever they allowed him to acquire. So I did feel like that was very interesting as well. And I thought that was a truthful statement, sort of like when you made the statement to us that after a Black president, man, they'll put anything in the White House. I think that's been holding true pretty much as well. There was one more thing I wanted to say. To me, in this day and age, when we have the ability to put out media such as a movie, you have the ability to rewrite history. It's not wrong. I never see a white movie where their heroes die at the end, or you know, they'll rewrite the story, even though they, you know, they'll make it a little fictitious just so they can have that happen. And then I think that's something that we lack, trying to be so historically accurate instead of trying to think of the future. We're stuck in the past. The future generations who would have watched that, and if the story turned out to be, you know, they won, they killed the people, they got away. Imagine the mindset and the psyche of the kids after seeing that. You know, it would have changed, I think, in my opinion. It would change the way they would think. It'll change their perspective and give them a different perception. And I'll mute my line. Thank you, Gus.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir, Mr. Steele.
Awesome. I just want to say that, you know, BGQ, you are more than welcome to conflate conspiracy theory and white supremacy together, but I caution against it. And here's why. Many people regard acknowledging that we are in a system of white supremacy on the same level as they regard, you know, did we land on the moon or 9/11 truthism or any sort of, you know, typical conspiracy theory that you can think of. So I would definitely caution against conflating the system of white supremacy. Yes, which is if you want to use the legal definition of a conspiracy, more than one party working together to, you know, affect an action. Yeah, you can definitely say that. But if you are going to start putting it in the same realm as chemtrails and lizard people and all of these other conspiracy theories that are out there, these Alex Jonesian, Mark Dice, you know, Ron Paul style diversionary, confusatory conspiracy theories, then, you know, be my guest, BGQ, but I just caution against it. And I'll go ahead and mute my line.
My only comment would be Alex Jonesian. I think that's a metaphor, and specifically because I'm sure we have some folks who don't know who Alex Jones is, so they might not exactly understand what's being said or some of the other names that were used for comparison. Number again, 641-715-3640, and the code 564-943. Pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Also, about being mindful with terms that are used, at the same way that I encourage folks to be mindful about the use of the term fair, I would also be mindful when people start associating black with something vile or foreboding. The weather has been difficult the past week in Seattle, and I don't think it's going to improve anytime soon. They had a big article in the paper at the beginning of the week calling it the Big Dark because there's supposed to be clouds. There was literally a cloud stream from the western part of Washington state that stretched all the way to China, and they had a big satellite image of this in the paper, and they were calling this the Big Dark. I think you heard in one of the audio clips at the beginning where they were saying when Trump took office, it was like a darkness set over the city, and they were talking about all these different problems they were having in their local elections related to racism. But be mindful of that as well, where it's consistently just another means where racist man, racist woman, racist child, they can associate something vile, evil with blackness, by extension, black people, again, enforcing white supremacy. Did other folks have commentary they wanted to make sure they got in? Did folks see where Lupita Nyong'o, she also came out and spoke about how she was subjected to abuse from Harvey Weinstein. And I think he actually came out and refuted her allegations and said, you know, he didn't do anything incorrect around her, that this was, you know, false allegations, what she had charged. I think they even had one article that pointed out this was, at least at this point, this is the only time that he has publicly refuted someone who has accused him. And they thought that that was significant because I think Lupita Nyong'o is the first black accuser to step forward and say that she was also subjected to his sexual harassment, sexual abuse.
Yeah, can I be heard?
Hold on one second, Mr. Steele. Thought I heard multiple folks speak up. There's another call.
Oh, that was, yeah, I was just going to say that. Yeah, I didn't see that. But I'm not surprised because Harvey Weinstein, per se, where does he go? Where does he have to go now? He has to now tack himself on to the black people. His credibility has been shot in white Hollywood. No one's going to want to work with him. They might let him fund or finance some things, but right now his market, his audience that he has ability to make money off of is the black audience. So as soon as that black girl came out, no, not her. You know, that's how I take it. for him to not deny anyone else's charges, and he's been charged, he's been accused by some pretty big white stars. I mean, he's a leading ladies in movies, and for him to take this, you know, one little black girl, that's the only reason why I could think, because I can't see it being the fact that he's saying I don't like black people or something. I think it's him trying to save face in the black community so he can still have a place to make some money.
Do folks think this is going to have an impact on Quentin Tarantino, like where people kind of look at him like, oh, man, you were enabler, you were complicit. I don't know if we should support your work. Do we think this is going to impact Tarantino as well?
No.
Let's get Mr. Steele, then we'll get I think that was Roz.
No, Tarantino will be A-OK from what I can tell. I personally witnessed a suspected white supremacist within the Chicago comedy community come out amidst the Me Too hashtag trend, came out and basically admitted to participating in behavior that could be deemed to be sexual, what they're calling sexual assault. And everybody praised him for being forthright and admitting that he is a woman violating creep. And it was when I called out that, you know, he was essentially showing off the fact that he was able to get away with all of these, I guess, admitted crimes. It was said that, you know, I was the problem. So I think if you want to take that sort of behavior, which is dealing with people within the Chicago comedy community, which is in show business, if you want to translate that to here in California and Hollywood, I don't think that anything will happen, especially after he came out and admitted that he was complicit in allowing this behavior to go on. And, you know, I suspect that this behavior was allowed to go on because they all engage in that sort of behavior. It's just Harvey Weinstein's turn to be under scrutiny for it. I don't think that there's going to be any sort of significant change in the way that Hollywood operates. And anybody who's getting into entertainment, again, I'll stress, learn to use the phrase, no, I'm not going to do that. I said that phrase to multiple producers this week. There were just a number of things that I was offered that, you know, just they were not advantageous to me. And I didn't go forward with them. I was in Beverly Hills. I was thrown out of a moving vehicle for not participating in some of the shenanigans that were taking place and that I was expected to allow to occur. And I guess my consequence for not allowing that to happen was that, yeah, I was pushed out of this moving vehicle. And you know, honestly, I had the option to say yes, that I could have participated and I could have allowed myself to be violated, and I could have positioned myself to be subject to more mistreatment in exchange for, get this, advancement in my career. So, you know, honestly, a lot of these people, if you go into the Lupita story, she complies and could have easily have said no the whole time. Everybody should be aware of that. And to participate in that industry, in entertainment, you know, are you willing to pay the price that people are going to offer? And I don't know if you are I don't know if you're being victimized, if you are doing something in exchange for something else. So that's just the way that people are operating out here. It's really disgusting.
Hmm. I think a lot of times racists, that's how they do their victimizing, put you in situations where they have more power, where they can coerce you into making choices. That at least would be my view. Roz, did you have commentary you were going to get in?
Yes, I did. Yeah, that's the industry. And I think everybody from the first black people who got into the entertainment business that were forced to, you know, play the role of subservient step and fetches or whatever other names they came up with for us, it was the same thing back then. They just have refined it to the point where white people are protected, like Harvey Weinstein, until he violates their code and then they expose him. I was going to say, I don't think Tarantino will have any negative effects for hiding Harvey Weinstein's sexual terrorism. What I think is, if anyone has a personal allegation of mistreatment by Quentin Tarantino, then they will go after him. Because what I've noticed is other people who have spoken out against him, one very famous one, Jimmy Kimmel, came out with a lot to say. And then days later, a couple of women said that he was sexually terrorizing them by having them grab his crotch. And they had like footage of it. They had like quotes from times where he was filmed. I mean, was caught saying these things, telling women to grab his crotch. So I think if there was any sort of personal allegation that any actresses or actors had towards Tarantino himself, then he would have negative effects. But because no one has come out against him, I think it's just, hey, he was practicing the code. This is what they do. We protect each other. And I think that nothing really will come of it. Also, in reference to Lupita Nyong'o and him coming out to speak out against her allegations, I agree with Thomas in New York quite emphatically. And it just reminds me of when we discussed Rosa Parks and the epidemic rape of black females that would take place when they would work as domestics in a white household, to the point where it was such a systematic custom of abusing black females that basically black females could not even accuse a white male of rape. And I think that that's pretty much what it is. It's almost like that, in addition to what Thomas said, not only is he protecting the black base that he's going to now probably seek to make some inroads with in order to make money, but also it's a black female can never accuse a white male of raping her or sexually terrorizing her. I think it's just like a redux of that sort of behavior from Rosa Parks' time. Thank you, and I'll mute my line.
Indeed. If other folks wanted to comment on that, that's fine as well. I just wanted to make sure I got this in before we went off the air. We heard that segment on the situation in Flint where they've been speaking to this black mother for a year and some change now about the water situation up there and how she's dealing with it, how her children are dealing with it. That type of content I think of as a vile form of white supremacy that's pretty flagrant, right? It's out in the open, but I think a lot of times people don't recognize or wouldn't think of that as racism. In my view, that seems like a problem whites could easily solve, even if it's that individual family. Like, oh man, we heard this. You know, how much does it cost to get them 10 gallons of water a month? That's not an astronomical figure. That's something, you know, one listener could take care of that easily. Like, I've seen white people waste that much money at the coffee shop, like in one weekend, or at the bar in one evening. That's something they could take care of easily. They have a black person for a year where something basic, water, for a year, and we just sit and watch you struggle with no water for a year. I just feel like that's just total white supremacy. This is a problem that could be easily solved, but no, we'll just sit and watch you and even kind of make it entertainment as we come back to check in. Mm-hmm. How are your children? Mm-hmm. Wow. Are you still having to trek 5 miles again? Wow. Well, we'll come back and visit next 5 months. Just that's the way it seems to me. I mean, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe they're, you know, trying to make sure that people are informed and don't forget about the situation that happened there. And maybe that'll lead to them actually getting the problem corrected. But I just feel like whites do that on a pretty regular basis. Problems that could be easily, that white people could solve quickly. They'll just sit around and waste time and get a lot of enjoyment seeing the black people suffer. Did other folks have commentary? We only have less than 20 minutes now. So any other comments folks want to make sure they get in?
Can I be heard, please? Yeah, I wanted to say, man, I wish Ken Luck, Ken Shell all the luck, man, in his pursuit of his movie career doing comedy, because we definitely need some black content that is real black content. I happened to binge this week. I watched two black movies, so I watched that terrible Birth of a Nation. I think the first Birth of a Nation was better. And then I watched the Hidden Figures movie, and that was just horrible too. I mean, I was so pissed off watching that movie, but I came to the conclusion that we should all call ourselves computers from now on instead of black people. You know what I'm saying? See if that how that changes things. Because they need computers, just like they need black people, but they don't acknowledge that. You know, so I would love to see if we all started calling ourselves computers, see how they would treat us. I had a workplace racism. This can't even work till Thursday. This happened to me just last night. And I happened to be, I apologize, the night before last. I was cleaning the operating room. And in the morning, when the shifts change for the nurses and the texting things, they come in and set up for their cases, their early morning cases and things of that nature. So I was, cleaning the room. And I was finished, but I was throwing out some trash. So when I got back to pick up the rest of my equipment, the white nurse had on YouTube, and she was standing there dancing. So someone started, talking to me, so I stopped, and I didn't really pay no attention to what she was watching. But when I did get into the room, I walked up on her singing Cardi B song. And all I walked up on her was saying was, "I'm going to let all of these hoes know that none of they niggas is safe." I had to walk back out the room like, oh, my God. Like, I just thought that was telling. I meet my mom.
Context of white supremacy, indeed. Just for folks, if they did not see it, the letters that they released this week that former President Barack Obama wrote to his white girlfriend, I guess Emory University, has these letters, and they're going to be available for display, but they released photographs and some portions. The report reads, "Your call gave me a boost," reads a letter from young Barack Obama. It was April 14th, 1984, and Mr. Obama had transferred to Columbia University in New York City as a junior 3 years earlier. The letter was addressed to Alexandra McNear, his girlfriend at Occidental College in Los Angeles, where he had transferred from. Somehow, a clutter of numbers and appointments and bills had grown over your last letter, wrote Mr. Obama, 22 at the time. Hearing your voice was like discovering a passage in a book I had read a while ago. This is one of a series of handwritten notes that have been obtained by Emory University's Stuart A. Rose Manuscript Archives and Rare Book Library in Atlanta and will be available to the public for the first time. These are 9 letters in total, all from Mr. Obama to Miss McNear, and they shed some light on Mr. Obama's formative years, the unease in his own identity, his cerebral nature, sense of isolation, and even the mundane aspects of being a college student. I'll stop there. I'm not old enough to know if this is standard operating procedure. Like to say, President Reagan, a few years after he left office, did they release his love letters to people that he was quote unquote dating before he was with Nancy? If they did this, right, President Kennedy, if they released love letters to folks that he dated before he and Jackie Onassis were married. So I don't have context if this is standard, but to release love letters that he wrote to some white chick from what, and they even have pictures of the white chick in some of the different reports where they're writing about this. Classic insert cowbell. Did other folks commentary last few minutes before we wrap things up? Any other commentary folks want to make sure they got in?
Well, yes.
You go. I'll go after you.
Okay. Thank you. No, I just I thought that was fascinating too, Gus. The timing, and in other words, to imply that, well, he may be your black president hero, but here's some things that you don't know about him yet, and we'd like to shed this light on who you think he is. They don't do anything without a purely racist, white supremacist motive. So that's interesting and fascinating. But regarding the Lupita situation, I just wondered, I don't see the value myself, if I don't think I would have come out and said anything regarding the Weinstein white terrorism, sexual terrorism. I really don't think, I think I would have just stepped back and observed and known that I would had had some possible entanglement with him, but I don't think I would have spoken out. And I don't think it was very strategic. I wouldn't have seen it as that, but that's just my observation.
What would have been,
say that.
What would have been the strategic advantage to say nothing?
Well, you see, you have all these, let the white women handle it. They have the power and they have the mechanisms and the power system of white supremacy to, if the goal is to reprimand him and severely as possible, I don't see how her contribution adds to the power system already in moving. I don't think for me strategically, I would have gotten involved with it. I don't see how it helps her career. I don't see how, you see, because we always end up getting slammed or reduced to something else, no matter what we do. So I don't think I would have gotten involved with it personally. I just don't see a strategic value in it.
Interesting. Raj, you were going to comment, sir.
Yes, just to kind of piggyback off of what the previous caller said, I just think because I remember once the Harvey Weinstein situation came out, they had had this whole hashtag MeToo thing where somebody had put out, if you were assaulted by Weinstein, you know, hashtag MeToo. And I just think that that put a false impression in Mrs. Nyong'o's head that the system was going to function in an equitable fashion with her, like it might have appeared to have been with the white females. So I agree with the previous caller in that sense. Anytime black people speak out, especially when it comes to sex and sexual terrorism by whites, you're going to be under scrutiny that no one else would be under. So I totally understand why she said that. And if she understood the system better, she might not have said anything just to let it play out, because it would have been white people against white people, and white people get things done. You notice people are pulling all kinds of things from him because he hurt white people. They don't care about black people, and she is really a dark skinned female, so she would have been under intense scrutiny regarding that. So I kind of agree with what the previous caller said. The other thing I thought about in reference to the release of former President Obama's letters with that ugly trash troll. She's hideous. All white women are hideous as far as I'm concerned, but she's especially hideous. What I thought about was whether or not the white female, again, F-E-E-M-A-L-E, because you pay a fee when you mess with white women, white females. I wonder if she released that information herself to get paid. She might have held on to those 9 letters, said, hey, he's no longer president. I can make some money off of this. Let me just release these letters. Where did they get them from? Did somebody steal those letters, hide them, and wait till now? Or was it that female herself who said, hey, I can capitalize off of this and maybe make a few dollars. Let me release these letters and further provide confusion for victims of white supremacy who think, you know, it's okay to go after white females because, you know, the former president had a white female. Not only that, but he was, you know, really chasing after her with some intensity. It's going to create further confusion in a system that is so confused, it's nauseating, between the sexual confusion that's being propagated, the economic confusion, the racism, white supremacy holistically. It's just, that just adds to the confusion, and it puts the former president's face on that confusion, which I think would be worse for victims of white supremacy, because most of us look at him as like the first black president, and we attach significance to who he is in the history of this country. Thank you. I'll meet my line.
They did say in that report, the director of the Emory Library, which is in Atlanta. Incidentally, if people are looking for an outing, a field trip, that's something that I do encourage, right, for people. If you're in a specific location to try to do things to learn about the local area that you happen to be in,
So that would be anybody, if you're in Atlanta, go to Emory University, go to their library, check out the letters. You can make a counter-racist report, write it up, and share. But they include in the report that the director of the Emory University Library, that he said that these they obtained these letters. The director of the Emory Library declined to reveal who had the letters before the library attained them, other than to say that library officials were contacted by someone in the rare book world who acted as a middleman. And that's all they would say. And I think I commented earlier about white people withholding constructive information. Mr. Steele.
Yes, you know, I did some research, and the woman in question, the white
Your
woman,
volume is a little low, sir.
My volume,
You can speak up, maybe. Okay, that's better.
Okay, yeah, I did some research, and I found the picture of the white woman that's in question regarding these papers, and she appears to resemble Bob Odenkirk, if you're familiar with the comedian Bob Odenkirk, except she has longer hair and worse posture. So that is that's that. And then also, yeah, with respect to the with respect to the advantages of withholding the information about Harvey Weinstein, one of the biggest advantages of withholding information regarding sexual terrorism in this context is that you get career advancement. I believe that following the alleged sexual terrorism incident, there was, I believe she became a cast member on an Oscar-winning movie in which she was allowed to play a bedwarming slave. So, you know, that is one advantage of not saying anything and participating with the, I guess, sexual terrorism that's going on there. And, yeah, I definitely think that she made a strategic error in participating in this situation. I think that all her story is going to do, if you read the particulars of that story, it's very easy for a racist to go ahead and call into question every other story that has come out as a result of this story being being revealed and the way that it's phrased. So, yeah, that's the one of the benefits of participating is that you could find yourself an Oscar-winning actress. So there you go.
Context of white supremacy. Again, Dr. Niana Rasayan, he'll be with us on Tuesday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. One of our favorite guests. We'll be looking forward to hearing from him. His website, eyesofmaat.com. eyesofmaat.com. He's been on the broadcast many times, dating back to 2011. So looking forward to hearing from him again. We'll get his thoughts on quite a few of the topics that we've discussed this evening, the black identity extremists, the Vegas shooting, and a few other topics as well. But looking forward to hearing from him. If you have a question, you can drop us an email. We are almost out of time. Does anybody have a final comment they felt like they needed to get in before we wrap things up?
I think Obama put those tapes out himself, or the letters out himself. I don't think that Obama's, to me, his sexuality is questioned, and this is a way to confirm, you know, what I think other people already know. I just don't think that he's into women. So I think that it was important for him to put these letters out to give off that impression.
And I did take a field trip today. I didn't really want to, but I had to go pick up my twin's birthday cake. And my daughter picked it out, though. But had to go to Ben and Jerry's, had to go to Rockefeller Center. And I took a bunch of pictures, and I sent them to Roz and a couple of other people. And definitely stealing our culture all over. They just painted everything white. And you could definitely see all the our symbolism. But they also have, and I walk past this thing every day, swipe my car, went on the elevator, never paid attention to it. All the pictures are the slaves all through the lobby of 30 Rockefeller Center. It's so obvious, you know, all the little messages there. I took pictures of them. I'm going to send them to you, Gus, as well. But I did take a little field trip today. We were talking about field trips.
Absolutely. Learning local history, that if you have children, in my opinion, that is an easy way that you can teach them about racism, white supremacy, and maybe even give them some practical information that they can use in their classroom or other settings where they know more information about the very place that we live. Oh, now I know why this is named what it is, or how this came to be, or just more history about the town that we've been in. That's always great information, and you're learning about white supremacy, racism, what it is, how it works. Anywho, we'll be here, as I said, on Tuesday. Workplace racism, mentioned several times, Thursday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. If you have guest suggestions, if you have trouble finding something in the archives, if you have a question, drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. untiljustice@gmail.com. If you live in Atlanta, man, go check out the letters at the Emory University Library, the Obama letters, and give us a report back. I think they said they have like 9 of them on display. Check it out. Let us know what you think. If you have children, that would be great. You can make it a whole family affair to go check out the library. And I think they would have other good items that you probably, you know, might be worth a visit at Emory's Library. Anywho, thanks for folks tuning in. I hope it was a constructive investment of your Saturday evening. I will stress again, sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. I know with the weather getting cooler and the year winding down, as someone mentioned, it is now time for all of those end of the year parties, for all of the horror days that are right upon us. Certainly, in my view, it would be great to keep that in mind. I think there are going to be lots of sobriety checkpoints for lots of these horror days, starting with Halloween. That's about a week or so away. Lots of checkpoints, and I'm sure that'll be the case for the other holidays that are coming up as we go down the stretch of the year. That is a great reason to keep that in mind. And then just, period, the evidence. Frequently, when we have a lot of alcohol or whatever other intoxicants, a lot of times it brings a lot of unnecessary and easily avoidable problems. We already have enough problems. Racist man, racist woman, racist child. We do not need any more. There's too much evidence that white terrorists have really exploited us when we have not been able to think at our highest ability and make quality decisions because we are intoxicated. Just on that basis alone, it would be a great counter-racist strategy, really promote and encourage practice sobriety, especially if you're going to be out and about in a vehicle. In addition to being sober, passenger or driver, make sure you buckle up. Anything and everything we can do to minimize contact with race soldiers should be employed at all times. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. With justice. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Shut up. A victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.